I don't have a problem as long as members will then follow the approach I'm going to adopt. That it is not unparliamentary not to speak on a matter that has been thoroughly articulated and dealt with by a member. Therefore, if we start now by 11:30, we shall conclude the presentation and deliberation of the presentations, commencing with our minutes. We've got a set of 7 minutes to deal with, and we may not have any other moment to do those minutes except today. Okay, then I'll check with the department as to which section is ready. Maybe the DG might practice to give a synopsis of their presentations. If in terms of the arrangement, the presenter will commence immediately, I don't have a problem with that.
No, thank you very much. The presentation would be as well reflected on the invitation, because the report should not deviate from that. Therefore, we'll be starting with the establishment of the two new institutions, of which I will ask for the Guy Parker as well as Mr. School in taking us through. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. We are going to give a quick presentation of the progress towards the two new universities. In the overview, we just indicated the various aspects that we'll be covering. I won't go through that in detail, but you can see them there. In terms of the proclamation of the university as a legal entity, that is the issue that is pending at the moment. We have established the particular address of the university, we know the type of each university, so we're both comprehensive. The minister has appointed the interim council for each university, and we are now going through the final process of the minister making a decision on the name for each university, after which we will be gazetting. We expect these two new universities to be gazetted possibly in the second week of July. The minister has to meet with the interim council members in order to take that process forward. This is a key aspect of getting things on the road in terms of ensuring that the implementation plan is followed through on and that the institutions do begin in 2014. In terms of the land assembly, this was a critical aspect of development. We had to ensure that all pieces of land were secured for each university in order to finalise the physical address, and that was done with the confirmation of all publicly owned land. In Northern Cape, the sign-off on the various pieces of land was done with the Northern Cape Premier, the MECs, the Municipality Executive Mayor, and the Francis Bard Executive Mayor as well. And in Mpumalanga, it was with the Premier and the MEC. There are some additional pieces of land in the Northern Cape, specifically part of the EBT College and the Diamond South School, and we've got agreement with them around that land, and then we are in the process of engagement with Transnet, with the support of the Department of Public Enterprises, to finalise the last piece of land. But all essential land and all the stock at these new universities and for our construction to begin has been secured. There are some ongoing issues that we have to deal with, specifically user agreements on shared amenities in Kimberley, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. Also, issues around road infrastructure and upgrades that need to be done around the sites of the universities, which we have to do with the municipal authorities, and issues around bulk supply contributions. In terms of the academic and institutional establishment for the Northern Cape University, it will be a comprehensive residential university with a strong seat and potential for future multi-campus expansion and growth. Specifically, we are planning for the main seat and that campus at present, but the new university, once established, can explore the other possible expansion of campuses as funding becomes available. We have a plan for start-up institutional establishment supported through partnerships, specifically with the University of Free State and Cape Peninsula University of Technology. You will recall this as a comprehensive university, so in other words, it's offering both formative programs as well as technology-type programs, so we have two universities involved. We are working with the CHE and the HEQC around the accreditation and quality assurance processes, and this is on track for the start-up programs in 2014. In terms of the start-up, we are talking about a small-scale start-up in selected programs. We cannot have a huge intake in the first year because we have to ensure that the infrastructure fits with the possibilities, and we are using existing infrastructure for the start-up program in both universities in 2014. So we're starting with three programs in the Northern Cape, the Bachelor of Education, specifically focused in Math, Science and Technology Education, an Information Technology Diploma, and a Retail Business Management Diploma. In terms of the longer term focus, we have identified specific iconic programs as part of the PQM that will be developed. And for the Northern Cape, one area is the area of heritage studies. This is an area that we have very underdeveloped in the country. We have a crisis in many of our museums where people are not properly skilled to deal with the various exhibitions and so on, and therefore we have decided that this is one of those areas which we can develop in the Northern Cape as a speciality. Linked to that are a variety of different kinds of heritage studies, including architectural restoration, which doesn't exist at the moment at any other institution, and architects have to go overseas for that kind of skills training, and also indigenous language, specifically the Khoisan languages. In terms of Mpumalanga, again, it's a comprehensive university. It will begin as a multi-campus university with two campuses, and that is the Lofbelt campus where the current Lofbelt College is and the C.F. Joshua campus, the former Mbeki College of Education, which will focus on foundation phase and intermediate phase teacher education. The academic programs and institutional establishment have been supported by two universities as well, University of Johannesburg and University of KwaZulu-Natal. in terms of accreditation, we're in the same process there in terms of ensuring that there is accreditation of the startup program for 2014. And again, it will be a small-scale startup in selected programs. And those programs are the Bachelor of Education Foundation phase, the Bachelor of Agriculture, and the Diploma in Hospitality. In terms of the college academic programs as we develop, agriculture will be a major focus of the new university, and we will be developing specific programs in relation to that, as high-level programs as well. And then African languages teaching will become a focus, particularly of the work on the Mpumalanga Sea Bushman campus. Continuing then in terms of the research, the way in which we envisage this university is that if it's a university, it has to deal with both the development of all types of programs. We are designing this university as the first two universities in our democracy. Therefore, as part of a post-school system, it will offer all types of programs from certificate through to PhD in particular niche areas. So while we'll have a broad academic base at the bottom, we will select specific niche areas at the top. We are in discussion with the NRS around the development of some research chairs and linked to centres of excellence, initially in heritage study in Khoisan languages for the Northern Cape and agriculture and African languages teaching for Mpumalanga. We also are in discussions around partnerships and links to various types of research institutes and other institutions to create strength for these universities, including institutions such as the Agricultural Research Council, which is located right next to the new university in Mpumalanga. We're looking at the development of skill centres attached to the university, and obviously we have to also consider the issue of bursary programs and funding for students, particularly in the initial start-up phase. And we have just had discussions with various departments around that. In terms of the institutional establishment, it's important for us to understand the difference between the infrastructural establishment and the institutional establishment. The institutional establishment is about the processes, the procedures, the organization, and the people who will make this institution into the future, whereas the infrastructure is obviously on the physical aspect that has to grow with the growth of the institution. In terms of the institutional establishment, we have a very comprehensive set of guidelines to hand over to the Interim Council. This includes all policies that a university may need. It will be a living document. As the Council requires a particular policy, for example, on human resources, they will utilize that as a basis for their work going forward. We have a draft partnerships ready for handover to the new university as well. They will have to consider that and sign those agreements with the partnership institutions. We are expecting that the interim councils will appoint interim management as soon as possible. We have identified possible people to be seconded from current universities to assist with that so we can have an immediate starter. I won't go through this in detail. There has been in-depth feasibility and site verification study that formed the basis for our bid to Treasury last year and the awarding of funding for the new university. We have an architectural competition underway for both universities at the moment in terms of the detailed planning aspects. The plan for the initial construction start up for the campus in the central campus in the Northern Cape have been lodged, and we wait for those in order to start construction. Construction has already started on the Tiabisha campus in terms of refurbishment of the residences, and we will be also looking at the start-up there. The economic impact assessments have been done, and the environmental impact assessments are underway for those parts of the campuses that are where it's required. Importantly, the way in which we develop implementation plans for each university is that we see these as developmental. The universities will be developmental as funding is available if they will expand and develop, and there is a 10-year development plan to get the university from their first intakes in their first year all the way through to all types of programs being offered and for the institutions to be established effectively. In terms of the funding expected for capital and operational costs, we estimate in current grant values that the total cost of the Northern Cape University will be in order of 6.6 billion and for the University of Mpumalanga, 10.3 billion. And you can see we are planning for 5,000 full-time equivalent students and 15,000 full-time equivalent students respectively. There is lots of space for further growth later to become larger than that. In terms of the implementation plans, we've got full implementation plans worked out for each university, and they are shown in form here for the infrastructure development. We have two maps, and we'll go into a more detailed discussion on the actual infrastructure and spatial development and take you through some of the aspects of each of those plans. I'm going to hand over to Mr. Hansen, who is our spatial planning expert, to take us through this part.
Thank you, Dr. Parker. Chair, I'm briefly going to run through the spatial developments of the two universities and just briefly what kind of approach did we take to address, first of all, developing two new campuses which haven't been done for a good 20 years and what would drive such a plan. And I think, first of all, the informant is first and foremost the academic mission. That would drive it. And we see the spatial implementation just as the enabler of all that. I think as a second thing, we have to look at what are the design performance qualities of such a university. What would it represent and what would it stand for? And I think that would be also an important spatial driver as to what this university looks like, because it does represent the first two new universities since 1994. And then thirdly, are the informants as to the place to relevant issues, the context, the academic programs that go with it. So those three things are the sources that we've looked into. I'm going to start off, with, first of all, with the new university in the Northern Cape, Kimberley, which was selected through a quite lengthy process of looking at a variety of sites. And the choice site for this is, for the 5,000 students, is the inner city of Kimberley. A lot of questions have been asked, why wouldn't this be placed on the periphery or on a vacant site outside somewhere in the six? The intention is that, first of all, 5,000 students really require amenities and structure to support it to be actually a viable place. It's quite a smallish scale thing, and student life is not only about academia, it's about all the support that goes with it. And Kimberley offers a fantastic opportunity to host something like that, and we really foresee Kimberley becoming a new university town. And I think that, therefore, we have selected the inner city, which on that image, just to the south of the big hall and the former old CBD. We have gone to extensive discussions with the City Council on numerous levels. And I think we've always gone from the perspective that the plan of the university is the plan of the city, and the plan of the city is the plan of the university. So we are fully ingraining ourselves into that urban environment rather than seeing ourselves separate of it. So we have to be very sure that we engage with them on a variety of this, be it from the movement strategies all the way to bulk infrastructure, sports and recreation and the like. So we don't see ourselves as a separate entity at all. It's also a city of heritage with a variety of tiers of heritage overlaying, from Lade all the way through to the mining magnet. And I think that the university can enliven again. Other informants include the academic program, which Dr. Park has referred to, and these have been converted into physical space. What does it mean to go out to 5,000 students? And given that we're all trying to look at between 75 and 80% of those students who will be living in residences, which is a large number, we are looking at approximately 190,000 square meters of block to be developed over the next 10 years for completion, at least for that first phase of our development, and all those have to be taken into account. Also, we've developed a quite detailed program as to how that will be implemented over time. We have to be ahead of program all the time to ensure that we can keep up with the ever-increasing student intake that comes with it. This just provides you with an aerial photograph of the study area that we looked at, and it shows to the... Well, of course, just to the north of the picture, the top part of the picture is the inner city in the big hole, for those who are not that familiar with Kimberley. And then right at the center is all the commission that is going to be built there, and it will share the stage with all, with council, the High Court, and the like. We're also going all the way down to some existing educational amenities, like the FET colleges, and then quite a large vacant space which is currently owned by Transnet, which is called Hopper Park. We're also looking at existing buildings. Although most of the development is new buildings, we are also looking at existing buildings and converting those for the use of the new university place and point, and these will come up later. These will be converted for use for 2014, so contracts are already involved to renovate these buildings for that first startup, which includes a former legislature building as well as the William Prescott School. And these are other images of Kimberley, and I think it shows some of the more important buildings in it, and as photos it has the Oppenheimer Memorial Gardens, and that's going to be where the iconic part of the university is going to be situated. So the council has offered up that land, and we will quite sensitively go about it. But it's not only about land, it's also about partnership with the FET College, which is also on that site, and how we deal with them, so we're ingraining with them or integrating with them. But we're also very importantly dealing with the council, because we are not providing everything for this university afresh. So the Kimberley is blessed with a lot of amenities, be it from sports and recreation to museums, and I think we as a university can contribute to that and rather have user agreements with the existing amenities, in this case the swimming pools, to update those for the use of the universities. And if there are amenities which are not within the university, that's what the university would provide, and we've already been in discussions with schools, et cetera, and that's all. We've got a couple of principles which we've been highlighting and discussing at length. I think the first and foremost is the integration. This is not a university which sees itself separately from the city. It really needs to ingrain itself basically on the dark infrastructure, on the movement, the movement patterns. And we've been very, very conscious that we don't necessarily have to provide new streets, but we have to upgrade those streets. We don't have to provide new electricity, water, and the like. We just have to upgrade it. I think that's where the sustainability and long-term sustainability of this university becomes very important. It is also about linking to these other amenities, be it museums and parks and sports fields, and the university will very much contribute to the update of those streets and the like, and I think that can be a fantastic benefit to the city as a whole. It is, student life is about walking the rest of most students don't have a vehicle transport, for instance, or private vehicle transport, so moving by cycles, public transport and the like becomes a very important thing, and we've been dealing with the council on that score quite heavily. We've introduced a whole new pedestrian walk, which we call sort of a string of pearls, where the student can amble at leisure. But it is wholly open to the public. It's nothing about this privatised or against put around. And I think this idea of just placing the university on it and just adding to what is already a very rich urban environment is an important one. There are places for celebration, places for outreach, places for exchange between the city and this university, I think, is an important underlying principle. The quality of the public environment is important because we have to demonstrate what good public spaces are. This is where students exchange and talk to each other and also exchange with their peers and their elders, and I think that's what the university is trying to stand for. It's not something which is putting away, it's really ingraining itself with that city. And I think we've gone through a variety of opportunities, be it swears and sports fields and the like, where these kinds of things can properly happen. We've also gone a long way in terms of what does it look like? What does the university look like? Which is part of the university? What do the streets look like? What do the residential components look like? And I think we're taking that a long way and we're starting to create a good idea as to how we're going to intervene. This shows the Oppenheimer Park as to how we're going to place those buildings in a heritage environment, and I think we've been quite sensitive and responsible in that regard. We've gone through plans as to where everything is located. There is talks about a mixture of academia, residences, and amenities. There's no sort of segregation in that score. Over the last 5 or 6 years, the department has invested heavily in universities, and the 22 universities have demonstrated in various forms, either be it housing or academic buildings, the best practices we've got. These are examples of buildings that we've put on either in BITS or at other universities of academic buildings, and all of those are used as precedents for the new university. So these are the things that we've learned over the last 5 or 6 years, and we're going to start applying the same rules and precedents and qualities to the new universities. And these are form part of our instructions to architects and professional consultants to follow. So for the university in the Northern Cape, the same we've seen before, we've got a stage strategy plan, it's staged properly so that it shows in terms of where we're going to start. Those sort of red buildings are existing buildings which we're going to convert. That's what I spoke about earlier. And the portion indicated in blue is the portion which we're going to start building come September. That's also the fifth part of the competition. So all those plans are in place. This just gives you an indication of some of the strategic plans that we are dealing with existing buildings for to ensure a proper start in 2014, both in the former legislature building as well as the William Hitchcock School. So some of these places and buildings are just converted for that purpose. We are also doing a launch which is planned for the 24th of September, which is going to be in the focal square the arrows point to, and it will be take the form of finishing a square with an exhibition around, open-air exhibition, which gives the people of Kennedy and Normtec an exact idea as to what this university is going to become. So people can visit it. It will become part of the launch and the official soft opening and opening event. There will be a miniature tower that goes with it. I think we're quite excited about this, but it will also demonstrate the kind of quality that we are looking for this university. So the best practice in those, so the swing has gone out, those seminars, and they will be on site very soon. And there is a commemorative beacon plan and artists involved in doing that, which sort of commemorates the start of that university. If you announce that very much the same process has been followed, but I think there's one large difference, and I think it has two things really. One is that it's vacant land, an open piece of land, an agricultural environment, so it's basically a greenfield environment, so a very sensitive natural piece of land which we have been custodians of and we care for how we deal with. The other one is always the scale of the university. The scale of the university is slightly bigger, between about 15,000 students, so the land portions that we've earmarked for this and decided upon is a bit more. As you can see to the bottom of the picture is the old Melbourne inner city environment. We've got the legislature, which everyone probably is familiar with, and right opposite that is the former Lowside Agricultural College, which is a 250-hectare property that we've earmarked for this new university. Again, we are dealing with all the local councils and local district municipalities in terms of all planning and rezoning. We have a bit of a longer legislative process in terms of the AA approvals because we are dealing with a much more sensitive environment, so we do perceive the process to be long in terms of planning. We have to deal with large regional infrastructure, roads and the like, because the connectivity is not as intimidating as direct and needed. So there are some more intricate and more difficult training issues that we deal with the local councils. Public transport and access for students becomes an intricate and very important part of it. So I think the principles are pretty much the same, but together by connecting, but we have, as I said, we have to do some major interchanges, road interchanges, which are currently in planning. Those things are in place. But as you can see, the plan of the university requires, while we are very well connected to some regional roads, we have to have a big interchange there. New entrances are planned. But in terms of the planning itself, we've just taken the old farm pattern and just formalized. So the old agricultural roads become the real roads, and we tar them and upgrade them. We also follow, as you can see, we're starting to do a hierarchy. We also follow the topography, which is very distinct. It has beautiful contours and overlooking the legislature that we're using the contours to locate the roads and as such. And it has beautiful vistas. And I think we need to sort of celebrate these things. And I think there's a fantastic opportunity for this university to become iconic. And there's a fresh start in more ways than one. And it is going to have and play the same role in our celebration as the legislature is doing. We have a responsibility to the natural environment, and we've got sort of no-go zones where we're not going to build. There were demarcated areas, first of all, natural environments, which we're not going to touch. But there are also beautiful orchards and like, which we're also not going to touch. We're going to leave most of that, and we've only allocated land, very specific land, which is annual fields, which we're going to build the university on. So we're not sprawling into land, so we're being quite conscious of that, not being wasteful with the land that's been given to us. So I think, again, there are some of the vistas that you will see and the relationship that the university will establish with the surrounding environment, as well as the topography, which I spoke to you about earlier, and I think we're trying to be as sensitive about this as possible. I think the university has to also talk about identity and what does it stand for in terms of what it looks like, and I think we are working very closely with the local community and the professionals in terms of making a thing which is of its place,
an identifiable algal space and not something like foreign objects. So we are working quite intensely with that. We're dealing with the other spaces, as I said earlier, and really trying to create a campus where students can exchange in numerous ways as best as possible. So I think we've taken, again, the architectural form a long way forward as to what can become. We are also looking at the academic program as to how we will cluster that, because we have a large land mass which we have to deal with, and we have to deal with efficiency and sustainability in a big way. We have to be careful that we use our resources properly, especially water and electricity, are being looked at in greater detail. Again, we are looking at a phasing strategy which, as a focus, will start with the existing local agricultural college, which is to the, on my arrow, rough, to the sort of eastern corner of it. That way we will start with the university, and we're already doing some upgrading of the existing amenities for the 2014 program to begin. But we also have already initiated competitions which will start with the iconic part of the university. Also, a launch has been proposed in October sometime, and I think we're doing exhibition panels again to announce it to the city and its citizens in a proper way.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Can we take questions and then commentaries on the presentations?
Thank you, Chair. I have a number of questions. Certainly, in terms of both universities, effectively we have 5 months because we can't count December. Now, it sounds as if everything is on track, but I am worried. Are there contingency plans? Because anything can happen in a building process. So what are the plans should something go wrong and we have students wanting to register? Then secondly, in terms of lecturers, you do say that there are arrangements with or agreements with universities. Will they be providing the lecturing staff, or are you going to recruit from scratch because time is running out? Student fees, has it been established yet for the students? Fees would be very affordable. Where are we on that? And then just in terms of the Northern Cape University, what will that university, how is it going to be presented to potential students? Why would they rather go there than travel 150 kilometers further to Bloemfontein? What will make it the first choice? And then I have a question regarding also Northern Cape University. What will be the language of instruction, because it is predominantly an Afrikaans and Swana environment. It is not an English environment. And you have, at Skorpsvis, you have both Afrikaans, mostly Afrikaans and also English. And then just lastly, in the courses that you're going to offer at Northern Cape, I think it's extremely good, and I'm very excited about the fact that you actually look at heritage and all the museum subjects, because there is really a shortage of that. But given the fact that the SKA is in the Northern Cape, why isn't that in the planning for the future? Because one would have thought that is in the Northern Cape, that is one of the hot spots or strong points in the Northern Cape. Shouldn't that university also perhaps be making a contribution to that? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Firstly, I want to check in terms of land preparation. You are saying by September you might be starting school of construction, but still in relation to sensitive areas in the Northern Cape that relates to festive sites and so on. And you have made mention of pieces of land that the municipality is disposing. Some of them might not necessarily be zoned for university space and so on, like the own residential areas, others might be owned differently. The process of zoning alone, it's a very long process. If we're talking zoning now until September,
to me it doesn't make sense. Unless you are saying to me you have received already the record of decision, some of the good studies you're doing. And you know that that can take a very long period of time. And talk to me about, do you have already zoned pieces of land in Northern Cape? That you say, I need to fully construct by September. And you've shown us some pieces of land that are saying the municipality is intending to dispose. And if you're saying still intending to dispose, you should start first the microtransfers from a number of people. And that could give us some problems. And I want you just to reflect the whole process of land preparation. The professor has also spoken about this element. The department at ABTG, we said we wanted different types of universities, not a duplication of what we have. Now, we began to, I can see the priority area here is focusing on program of foreign and education. Or we're going to use it to universities to substitute the training colleges for teachers. And then the focus area is on education, because you can see each and every one, it has a specific focus to education. Maybe you are saying that the development now because of those teaching colleges, now want these universities to focus on producing the teachers of women that we have. It's because we would be harmed, because with many universities that are in education now, also our lot of education that we have. And within the context of what the professor is raising, the CKR. In Bumalanga, for instance, it's a mining area also, but you say nothing about mining, balancing mining in agriculture in Bumalanga. It reminds me of what is happening to us in the Eastern Cape, where petrol is going to be built, but no university is offering anything that relates to energy and so on and so on. Therefore, I will take into consideration some of those elements. The issue of, if I say we are enrolling students in 2014, have we dealt already, unless I'm the one, with issues here of branding? I have not seen the branding models of the one name of this university. Have there been consultation in relation to that? I don't know the name, is it not the case university? If you are drawing people, now I have this idea that a university will be a Nelson Mandela University like the one I come from. What is it? What are the planning models of this? Have there been proper consultation? You are not telling us more about this thing. So it's important to us. Who is going to run this university? If we're starting a university next year, we can't be sitting here for a service not knowing who's going to head this thing. Or are going to take a branch teaching somewhere to run it. Do we have the process in place? Do we have the country? Do we have the management? When is it going to? When are we going to have the kind of management and council ready to take over them?
I think some of the questions are answered like this in the interim council. This comes up on. So I'm saying, yes, members, you must be focused. Speak as, in a manner that shows we're listening to the people.
I hope I will do that. I will speak or ask, demonstrating that I was listening. And where I was in. Now you may be the cause, so I may not have. Let me not respond to you, because you're talking diligently on me, you don't have any to any conference. So it's fine. Just two things, Chair, or three. What determines the intake that you're talking about? You talk 5,000, you talk about 10, if I'm not mistaken, and so on. But what determines that? I know there could be several factors. Firstly, it could be capacity in terms of infrastructure that you're supposed to have. Secondly, it kind of stuff that we were supposed to have. It could as well be the funding, loans and bazaars that you could have. You told him provincial bazaars that will likely be available, and we don't even know cash by now, but things that we're talking about. To me, that is probably going to be limiting effect in terms of access, because likely you are going to rely on those who may fund themselves if the provincial bazaar is not a bigger cake. It may mean that you've got categories that may not access these institutions as they offer. I just wanted to talk about and clarify what determines this intake and to what extent they can be limited in that regard. The other, you talked to even diplomas, which probably will run for a year. Now, all it means to me is that we may not be sure in terms of sustaining that institution. I'm looking at the intake that will run for a year and prepare for a year from now and prepare properly for the other years later. I'm trying to get at what even led or what could have been at the center of why we picked even on some of these programs. Was it readiness in terms of other areas, or what exactly was the issue?
Thank you.
Thank you.
My first question will be, again, programs like the one that is going to be offered in another Cape University, the one on heritage and river, which I think is a problem, but as it has been mentioned, one of the skills subjects or courses that left in the country. Then my question would be, when it comes to the issue of lecturers, scattered it is in the existing universities, and where are we going, what is it, what are the plans that we have? Because it might be good like this, but when it comes to the point of implementation, we find that there are problems. What is it that you can tell us about these gas calls and the lecturers thereof? Second, Mr. President, we have got me this. What can we say is the difference between the two universities that are going to be starting next year and the new year that you have? Because for me, there's a great relationship between the two, because the programs from other universities will be offered somewhere, but where can we draw a line between the two, the universities and the years that we have as of now? Chair, I know this one I might not be listening carefully, but I have to ask you, Chair, we're talking of small scale and incrementing. I'm not sure really, I went out and came back. The 5,000 that you have been talking, are we talking of the next year's intake there? If not, if I can get a picture, come January, what are we targeting? How many students are we targeting? Maybe the programs just for the funds that we have, just to have a clearer picture on that one. And I wanted to ask what Honorable Bama has asked just today, even how are we advertising this to the students? Are these programs for these universities being advertised in the universities that the programs will be coming from, or are we advertising as the university just to clear them out so that even when we go out there we're being asked, we are in the position to explain as to how are the processes unfolding. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. My first issue relates to the programs that are going to be offered. What informs them? I'm asking this because you have offerings like heritage studies, retail business management, meaning that it's business management that has some limitations or that will be offered to a limited extent. I'm also coming up with this question because whose provinces are mining provinces? And then we are not starting with engineering. We are not starting with geology. We are starting somewhere. Yes, of course, there's somewhere where people should be starting. But for how long will people from these provinces go out and do medicine in other provinces or in other countries? I'm saying these things because I don't want us to build historically disadvantaged universities. Again, we're talking about, we always say, as funding is available. When will funding be ever available? There will always be restrictions around funding. Are we saying we'll go and go and go and go until we're restricted by funding to do whatever we want to do? For instance, are we saying we will build deformed universities just because South Africa hasn't got 100 billion? Again, the issue of the availability of land is a sensitive issue. How long are we going to sensationalize the availability of land? The availability of land is an important issue in our country. All stereotypes must be thrown away at a certain point and get led to do what we have to do as a country. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. My first comment is directed to you, sir. On the beat of the last recommendation that the minister done last, I'm proposing that we have a specific time that we're going to stop at that given time. So we know beforehand when we get there. Secondly, can you confirm that last presentation, we don't have a copy of that? This very last presentation. We're not given a copy of that. There's no presentation there. That's much. The last one. Yes. My one question, Jay, is on page 18. Page 3. I'm going to slides that are not numbered. But those slides apply to my question. The third bullet on the first slide on page 3 says Asian to see HE accreditation and quality assurance processes on track for startup program in 2014. And then the next bullet gives us the courses, Bachelor of Education by FS, Information Technology by CTUT, the paid business management by CUT. If those courses are given by those universities, do they need accreditation?
Try and respond to those questions.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the questions. I think there are important issues that have been highlighted. In terms of the first one. I think the first set of questions really highlight some of the implementation issues around the new universities. The issue around the contingency plan is obviously a critical one. We have quite a detailed risk management strategy that we put in place, and I don't have a copy of it here, but as part of the implementation plan, in terms of each aspect and the kind of issues that we have risks on. And there are obviously some risks that are bigger than other risks. It may be linked to the question about why are we starting with these particular programs rather than other programs. And one of the reasons for that was around the risk mitigation. We needed programs that didn't require too much infrastructural development, detailed labs and so on, that we were able to start up fairly quickly, that needed minimum resources at the start-up process, and that we would be able to ensure could be implemented successfully. And for that reason, we only chose 3 programs for each institution which had those kinds of qualities, but were programs that were recognized as programs that would be important for the new universities going forward. We have developed a full PQM, a program qualification mix, for each university that takes through a 6-year period and involves a number of different kinds of programs, including programs such as the health sciences for nursing and emergency medical care, issues around engineering, particularly mining in the Northern Cape, and so on. And that is a draft PQM that was in place that we handed over to the interim councils and to the interim management to really embed and take to further processes as this institution grows. And by the end of the year, that PQM has to be finalized so that we are able to ensure that that PQM has funding associated with it going forward. In terms of the lectures for the start-up program, what we are currently doing through the MRA is looking at a mixture of different kinds of human resource requirements. Firstly, secondment of key personnel from existing universities to enable us to be sure that these are properly taught and managed at the institutional level. Secondly, the identification of people who are already on either master's or PhD programs that would be incorporated into the new university as developmental lecturers. And then we complete the programs with the universities that are at the moment while at the same time being developed as new lecturers. And then we will also have a recruitment project where once we've got the new institution in place and the interim management in place, the adults will go out for recruitment. And it's interesting that people have often said, well, you will go to the university in the Northern Cape, but we do have not quite a number of people actually writing to us on a daily basis saying, when are these adverts going to come out? We've heard about this, and we are also keeping a database of possible people there. So there's a multi-pronged process around this, but of course the recruitment of staff and the finalization of that can only happen once the university is established as a juristic person and once the interim management is in place, which should be fairly soon. In terms of the student fees, and perhaps I should indicate what we've done is we've developed a turnkey strategy for the interim council, which includes all aspects, including, for example, draft adverts for the various human resources that are required, a draft policy on student fees, a draft policy on all these different things for that interim council to immediately adopt as a consideration. The student fee issue obviously is linked to the whole issue of the feasibility study, and that we've got a draft ready for the interim council, and once it has adopted those drafts, then they will be made available. In terms of the language of instruction, which is also the issue that has to be taken up by each of the universities once they are there, and will have to define their language policy. The issue in Northern Cape around whether Afrikaans will be a language of instruction still has to be determined in relation to that, which is why the recruitment council starts until we've got the new universities in place and that decision as well. However, there is a draft strategy, a draft marketing strategy already in place, and in relation to the name has to be finalised by the minister, and he will finalise that and it will be completed. There has been a process of requests for possible names from stakeholders for the university, and those have gone through to the minister for consideration. In terms of the question around joining the SKA and other programs, we have interacted with the Department of Science and Technology around the SKA and what the kinds of programs may be required for that. From their perspective, the kind of program that the university could become involved in over the short to medium term would be more the technology program that would support work on SKA, which is very starting with the information, the ICT program. However, they do feel that many of the other kinds of programs related to the astronomy and so on are already well taken care of by existing universities and probably won't be developed by the university. But we have a number of different aspects for development of the PQM here, including issues such as environmental, arid environments and agriculture for the Northern Cape, and so after the earth, there's a large number of different possibilities, and perhaps once the new universities have looked at the draft PQM and finalized that we could do a presentation on the full PQM of each university that are each substantiated by specific business plan and feasibility studies. It leads to the issue of, for example, heritage studies. Each of these courses that we've identified, areas that we've identified, we've got an academic planning group working on that. The person who's working on heritage studies is a well-known academic, Professor Olivia, who is working as well with a number of different universities actually across the world, looking at possible links and connections. And there they are identifying the study programs, the extension programs, the research programs, and so on. And there are some business case studies written up for each of these particular aspects. In terms of the education, you will know that the integrated strategic plan for future education and development indicates an expansion of future education to various campuses. On the higher education sector, we think that it's very important that both of the universities take up education as key programs because the need for teachers in the system, and therefore education is part of what is being designed in relation to both of these universities. In terms of what's informed the size of each university, this comes from the initial policy exercise that is done in terms of what would a viable, sustainable university be as a start-up in each province. We are designing the university for flexibility and growth in the future. So we imagine even if the campus in Northern Cape in Kimberley can grow to around about 7,500 full-time equivalent students, but the start-up, which is explained through the feasibility study and the implementation plan for 5,000 FTEs. But that is the full capacity. When we start up at the beginning, we are talking about three programs. In Mpumalanga, the three programs are the education program, where we'll have an intake of around about 100 students, and we will be looking at about 25 students. The minimum number for viability for each program is about 25 students in each of the other programs. So when we're talking about small-scale scholars, we're talking about a small scale in terms of being able to get the university started, to get the first students on board, and to be able to then, you can imagine, as students come in each year and as we expand the program, move towards the full capacity of each institution within as good a time frame as is possible. And linking that to the funding, of course, if Treasury comes and provides us with more funding down the line, we can accelerate the implementation plan. What we've done at the moment is develop the implementation plan over a 10-year period, given what has been indicated to us as possible in terms of the funding made available. I think I'm going to ask Mr. Hansen to answer the question about the actual startup of the infrastructure.
First of all, the short period until 2014 in terms of startup, we are focusing it on existing buildings which are already currently used as lecture venues and have different spaces in part in them. So the conversion of those is actually quite a small change, so we can accommodate those for students. So I think that's the way we approach it, both cases, in the near buildings in Kimberley, as well as the local agricultural college that's converted some and adding. So that's the way we would hope to deal with 2014. But to do the new build, there are obviously huge restrictions on a lot of the portions regarding rezoning, EIA studies, the land parcels vary. So in some cases, they take longer, and that has influenced our implementation strategy plan. The reason why we can start with confidence on the Northern Cape as this new build stage is that the zoning is correct. We don't have to do an education zoned property, and therefore we focused our first start on that. The portions that we've been allocated by council would require a good 18-month process, but that will then kick in due course. But the land parcel available to us can already accommodate about 20% of the whole university.
So I think that's the way we approach the program.
Maybe just to add to that, obviously the phasing in across different aspects of the land becomes important in terms of that. But the question I didn't answer was the one about MeHead, and I just wanted to come back to that. The MeHead operates in each province to coordinate higher education activity. MeHead are key stakeholders in relation to voters and programs, and we're working very closely with each of them. There is a due diligence study at the moment that is going on in relation to each of the MeHead to identify what the future role may be in higher education, and we are working very closely with each of those members in order to identify how they will either coexist or be incorporated or brought into the new university going forward. We are expecting to get that report to us as soon as due diligence studies are being completed at the moment. And as soon as that happens, we will inform the minister, and then the minister will tell us more in relation to how we're going forward. But clearly, however we deal with the MeHead, they are absolutely key stakeholders and institutions in relation to the new university. We are coexisting with the MeHead and MeHead case. You will see in terms of the implementation plan, utilizing some of the space where they currently are, and the MeHead buildings are on the campus of the Northern Cape University. So the current programs offered in partnership with MeHead will be continuing into the future, and we'll be working around the implementation of space usage together with MeHead and the partner universities in that regard.
Yeah, and we also checked, the interim councils have already been appointed.
Yes. And we are putting behind them a high-level technical field team, as well as with requisite expertise, so that we do not go wrong, in the process. And the principles that are guiding the establishment of these two institutions is that firstly, they should be established as transformed institutions, integrated but differentiated. And also, they should not just project into being South African universities, but they have to take into consideration the need and the integration with SADC, the continent as well. So this is the kind of support that we are lending to the interim council as they have been established now. After looking far, far, far forward, beyond our lifetime, with the lack of a better word. Thank you.
Just to improve our understanding, I think in the presentation it was mentioned that these institutions are not yet established as juristic persons, and now interim councils are established. It will confuse me as a lawyer, you see, once you say that. Because the first thing must be a juristic person existing to which the council is appointed. Now, once you tell me that there's no juristic person by now, it's like we are already a council is existing in the air. Because the High Education Act does empower the minister to say, I am establishing two universities in Mpumalanga and Northern Cape, and to which I'm appointing interim councils. And we know from that process, the council can name whatever name the thing is proper in terms of the consultation that would have undertaken with local communities. They will determine the language policy and they will set how the process of appointing the vice chancellor and the clerical staff and so on. And they are the ones who will be ensuring that some of these aspects which we are asking rightly about now will actually be integrated. Just clarify that aspect for me so that we should not hear in the future that this council took wrong decisions, they were illegal because they were illegally non-existent, because it's very important.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Perhaps I can explain the legal process in relation to the specific development of these new universities. It was important for the Minister to identify who would be on the Interim Council. We had a nomination process in relation to that. The Minister then applied his mind in terms of those who have been nominated and also added new nominations to that list. Once we've gone through all the CVs and there was a proper process around that, the five Interim Council members for each university were identified, and the Minister has formally indicated to them that he will be appointing them as the Interim Council of the new universities. He will be having the first meeting with the Interim Council in order to discuss the naming of the university, having already held a process around getting information around possible name for these institutions. And at that particular point, a decision will be made and finalized, and immediately after that meeting, he will sign a gazette which establishes the two universities as juristic persons. At that point, the Interim Council will begin work. So they can't begin any work before the universities are established as juristic persons. The whole reasoning behind this was because we needed to ensure that the planning processes were in place. And that we have drafted, the high-level technical team has drafted all aspects for the Interim Council. So once the universities are established and they're in place, they're able to move very, very quickly into the implementation of this process. You know, in terms of the Act, the Interim Council otherwise would need to have done all this work early on, and it would still be a couple of years before the new university would be established. So we do recognize that this work is essential in order to ensure that the universities are established.
Chair, so just a quick follow-up. May I get it clear that the vagaries in this institution is limited to the provincial provision? We have not made any provision for that at a national level.
Both of those so difficult questions of mine were not answered. One was whether we're going to get a copy of the presentation because we don't have. The second one was based on page 3, that if you UFS is giving courses next year, do those courses need to be accredited?
Apologies, Paul. In terms of the bursary, we just mentioned that we are looking at processes with the legal departments around that. But we've also been in discussion with the Department of Basic Education around the Mishaka bursaries for education students. And we'll be looking at other options as well. For example, we've been in discussions with some of the companies like De Beers, who have indicated that they would also like to get into partnerships to support the university. So there are a range of different aspects that we're looking at as we go forward. But we do see student funding as an important aspect of success. In terms of partnerships with the institutions, we are working with these institutions as partner institutions and also be able to start up a program. So we're utilizing their programs but as new university programs through the partnership agreement. So the accreditation issue, these are already accredited programs, which mitigates against the problem of having to go through the long processes. But the universities are allowing new universities to start these programs with their students from the beginning. We're waiting for the HEQC processes to be finalized. They're still going through the process. They've been lodged and we're getting confirmation in terms of the processes around accreditation. The fallback position, and I say the contingency plan, would be that they are started in conjunction with the current universities. But in terms of our plan, we would be a new university program. I hope that answers the question.
Chair, I want to check with the presenters whether in this process that we want to speed up, that we reach 2014 so quickly, are we not going to commit? I'm very worried. You see, I sit here, like I sit in this committee. But the most important part
practical skills, with consultation, appointment. Remember, the new institution that was established. New. That all of us, the services, are supposed to be. But there are processes that are linked to appointment of a council of an institution, that is a Bronco one. They are about to be in the final stage. My fear is that are we not going to commit the same mistake when we're talking about major of institution, where we have to rush for deadlines when the decisions were made to establish quickly internal council with people with no capacity. In some institutions, they pay managers, some managers were appointed speedily, some of them were removed within a short space of time. Why, if we wanted to be which this university is at cost, because this is what we should attribute, but we told up for Northern Cape and Bumar, to the vice of the student leaders of those things, because they wanted people's universities for the most part. Now, are we not putting ourselves into a trap? That was saying, we just want to offer for the first phase programs that we are capable to deliver. Rather than wait for a longer period of time, prepare these universities to be able to deliver what the nation expects. Rather than in 5 months establish an institution and say you can run out an institution. Because councils have to do practical responsibility to establish the policies, rules of the university. And will that not catch with us in the long run? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I also share my colleague's concern, although one has a lot of appreciation for the work that has already gone into this. But I just have this feeling that anything can go wrong in this time, and it's only 5 months, and there are so many things hedging on certain things to take place first. So I think perhaps, Chair, we should have an update regularly to see the progress of what we're doing, because there are great expectations out there for these universities to be established. But just to get back to a very practical aspect again, Dr. Parker, because I'm sitting thinking here of myself as a potential student with expectations, and I'm going to this new university and the Ed Electra, will there be the additional support systems such as student support, your libraries? What do you have in place for libraries for the initial stage? Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you, Chair. The planning of establishing the two new institutions has been taking place over at least a 3-year period. And it's a planning that we rolled out with distinguished project managers, engineers in various disciplines of engineering from within the system. For instance, we've been working with a team drawn from VET, UP, UJ, engineers, because we didn't want to risk to work with engineers who do not have requisite expertise in terms of the establishment of an institution of this nature, of this magnitude. So it's something that has been thoroughly planned, worked out through, in consultation as well with Treasury and various stakeholders, provincially and otherwise. So that question of planning in terms of academic architecture, physical structure, it has been done quite thoroughly, and it's done now. It's a handover and the support to the new interim council to take the processes forward with our support. So in terms of planning, we don't have a problem. In every respect, we were prepared for anything. That's why we didn't want, in the process of that planning, to start the institution at a full-blown level, massive, because we are bound to make mistakes if we are to adopt that approach. The take-off must be very much meticulous. That's what we've been working for. That's what is in place at the present moment. If there could be any mess, it would be those who would be charged with that responsibility of taking the institution forward. But there are mechanisms of working on that. Regular update first. The support mechanisms have been put in place both for students as well as the physical infrastructure which would be required to support the students as they would be enrolling 2014. It's not a sum that we've worked out, but that everything. We haven't left anything to chance in that regard. Thanks, sir.
But I think we're clear that this is not a fixed strategic goal. It's a long-term dynamic process that will move from one stage simple to the complex. We really appreciate that. I think we'll go to the next presentation. Further engagement will always be, they will give opportunity to, I think full-time the committee is going to Mpumalanga. I think we're going to have an opportunity to look at the land where this university of Mpumalanga is going to be situated and clearly contextualize the presentations that have been advanced here. And then the report, I mean the presentation which process must be advanced to committee, maybe we need to make that available. That will be thoroughly helpful to us. And we hope NSFAS will contemplate that there are new entrants in the system that will emerge from Mpumalanga and Western Cape without having excessive reliance on the provinces. But we will appreciate deeply the contributions that will come from that side. So let's move to the next presentation. Thank you. Thank you very much for that presentation.
If you want the unbundling of the investor in Mpumalanga, thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. What I'm going to do now, I'll just take you through very briefly the process that we are engaged in terms of unbundling the recruitment process and the establishment of a new Health and Allied Sciences University incorporating the Mpumalanga campus. In terms of background, our Minister, together with the Minister of Health, appointed a technical team to review the impact of the merger of the Medical University of Southern Mpumalanga and the University of North, which resulted in the establishment of the University of Limpopo. And the team was led by Dr. Price from UCT and Professor McCorkle from UKZN. They presented the findings of that in early 2011 to the minister, and it was considered by the ministers. And in May 2011, the ministers did support the key recommendation, which was that the merger should be undone and that a new university should be established incorporating Mpumalanga. There was quite a lot of discussion about the model, but it was suggested that Mpumalanga could be established as expanded competency for medical education. In terms of the Higher Education Act, the Minister requested and received advice from the Council on Higher Education on the recommendations. The Council on Higher Education provided that advice in September 2012, and in relation to that, they agreed that Mpumalanga needed to be unbundled from the University of Limpopo. They also recognized that this would have to be done through careful process. They particularly were concerned around issues of quality assurance and the quality of programs at Mpumalanga, and they were concerned that sufficient funding would be made available to ensure that this institution was sustainable into the future. The Minister of Health and the Minister of Higher Education then appointed a joint technical task group to advise it on the processes for separating the Mpumalanga campus from the university, and also to ask the task team specifically to take into consideration the CHE's comments around sustainability and quality and issues around that. The JTT is comprised of a number of different bodies, specifically officials from the Department of Higher Education and Training, the National Department of Health, the Gauteng Department of Health, the Health Professionals Council of South Africa, South African Medical Association, and Selected Medical Dealers. So that team is made up of these individuals looking together with a specific research to enable us to develop the report. In terms of its work, there is a roadmap that has been developed which outlines the sequences and the processes for unbundling the campus. There has been engagement between the Minister and the University of the Health Council, and also joined the technical task team in the University of the Health Council. This was critical in order for us to get agreement around how we were going to be able to go forward, particularly in relation to the relationship between the joint technical task team, the University of the Health Council, and its work that needs to take place on the university campuses. We have published a gazette inviting interested persons or organizations to provide comments on the minister's intention to establish a university as part of our legal processes. And we have planned a number of different stakeholder engagements that we need to undertake in terms of the promotion of the Administrative Justice Act. Very specifically, engagements with the University of Employment Management, the Council, the Medical Campus staff and students, nutritionists, staff and students, and then a number of identified external stakeholders, specifically including other universities operating in the Gauteng area and various professional councils that are operating for the different allied and professional health programs. In terms of other work, we have established the legal framework for the establishment of the university. And that's part of the roadmap in terms of the work that has been done towards that. In terms of the Higher Education Act, we couldn't just take away the campus from the University of Limpopo. We had to have a new university that needs to be established first, and then that campus to agreement can be incorporated into the new university. In discussion with the Minister of Health, it was suggested that we need to really think about a sustainable model for a health allied sciences university, one that covers a variety of different kinds of programs, including basic technical programs. We're talking about a comprehensive medical university here. So the kind of engineering programs to support the types of equipment that we use in a hospital, which currently we don't have sufficient technology and materials to support, for example, including the medical doctors, the nursing, various mid-level health workers, and so on. So it's a quite wide range of programs and quite an extensive development from what currently is offered at Adenza. We have also been requested to look at the issue of veterinary science programs and to establish that again on that campus. It was something that had been there before, and it's a big need in the country to do that. Currently, we have done the research around what academic model might be suitable. There are examples from across the world that we looked at, and we have a document that describes the strengths and weaknesses of various models and recommendations in terms of what they could be. We are currently undertaking a feasibility study in terms of understanding what are the growth gaps and what needs to be done in order to ensure that we've got a sustainable university into the future. Therefore, also, the feasibility study will form the basis for the funding that will be required to establish this university and for that new MTSD. We've obviously got to deal with the whole issue in terms of the environment of protocol guidelines to determine transitional and future management arrangements for the institution. In other words, how do we unpack what is currently one institution to move it into the new institution? We are expecting that the report will be submitted to the Minister by the end of August in 2013, and we expect that we could establish the new university by January 2014 at a juristic person.
together with an announcement of the provisional arrangement, but the situation that will then have to take place will still, on a practical level, need to have a further amount of time. So we are looking at that separation being finalized by the end of 2014, with the first intake of new university students in 2015. So although the institution would be established in terms of having its own new interim council and its management, which would enable the negotiations with the University of Limpopo around the separation, the first program would only take place in 2015. I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Currently, there are efforts to employ staff that may be used by the Council of the University of Limpopo. How does that relate to the process of unbundling? So that by the time you start the university, you don't find philosophers having populated the structure of Medusa, and that they are not compatible with the sort of institution that we'd like to establish. And I guess the documents you have on the sort of possible models is only classified documents you can share with the committee so that we can start beginning to be part of the process and imagining this model as well as we work together with the committee so that we are not lost as politicians, as well as share our skills of intellectuality around that matter. So let's make sure that is made available. Yeah. Members, we can interact with the... Oh, yes.
I think we take note of the presentation and actually how far we are at the moment. Obviously, some more information is needed also from our side to really get informed as well. Like, for instance, the facilities at the new university, the funding of it, the people, the educational system that is involved. We see that the protocols and the guidelines are already established, but we need to get more information as we go along. So I would just say from our side, I think this is actually good to hear that the planning is progressing well, but we do also need to be informed regularly on what is the outcome and how far are we progressing so that we are also informed. Thank you, Chair.
Well, no, thank you very much. Last, we did, as a committee, visit Medusa campus. The staff there are really interested in being a separate institution. They are looking forward to the unbundling process. That is what I care about. The council seemed unexcited about it, but from the context of the people of Medusa, the staff and those that were interacting with were positive about the unbundling process. So we would like that to be expedited. Then let's proceed to the next report.
The next report, I'll ask Nadine to lead us on the resulting and the certification.
Honourable members, I'm going to be giving a report on the resulting certification progress made with regard to the backlog of the certification for our national certificate vocational candidates, as well as the resulting of the April 2013 primary examinations for engineering studies. Before I do it, I would like just to give a brief overview of the size of the examination system we're talking about when compared to that is actually administered by the Department of Basic Education. We are the examining body for the further education and training college sector as well as the adult education training sector. and in total we administer 9 examination cycles out in the academic year. And if we look at this, we are administering examinations and actually certificate of vocational qualifications, levels 2, 3, and 4, for related business studies programs in 4-6, engineering studies programs in 1-6, and the ABET GDC level 4 qualifications. So you can see quite a range of qualifications and the number of cycles each of those is indicated, which brings us to 9 separate examination cycles in a year. In addition to that, we set 1,500 question papers for these cycles, and these cover in excess of 500 subjects. I'll further repeat that, in excess of 500 subjects. In terms of the marking process accompanying that, we mark in excess of an estimated number of 3 million scripts in an academic year, and we service approximately 449 examination centres per academic year. That is as per the November 2012 exam cycle. That was the number of exam cycles that participated in that exam. That number does increase as new centres are registered to offer examinations. Then the matter of certification, if we look specifically at the backlog certification of our National Certificate Vocational Candidates, we acknowledged and have been acknowledging that there was a backlog in the certification of our candidates and have attributed this largely to the examination IT system that has been unresponsive and unreliable when looking at the requirements and needs of a system that needs to deliver on these two very important functions that is resulting in certification. Coupled to the instability of the system itself that the data is providing us with, we also had experienced other delays with regard to the capacity of the FITA in terms of rectifying the errors, in terms of our time turnaround time frame, also the nature of the data that FITA was providing to the quality assurer did not meet the format requirements, and therefore the quality assurer was not in a position to approve those data sets. And finally, in terms of the availability of suitably qualified officials that needed to do the task, we were limited to one programmer who knows the system, and that was all. When we last reported at the end of the fourth quarter, we said that we have not yet issued any certificates. I'm pleased to report today, Chair, that we have gone 66% of the way. If we look at the table presented on the slide over there, it gives a breakdown of level 2. We have issued all certificates collectively with Umuluti for level 2 candidates who sat for level 2 from the inception of this qualification back in 2007. So for your information, if you look at subject certificates are issued to candidates who have not completed all 7 subjects which make up the qualification, which are compulsory for the qualification. Full certificates are issued to candidates who have completed all 7 of those subjects successfully. So that's why there is that differentiation on the slide. And in terms of the total number of full certificates issued, 73,542 were issued across level 2, across all those exam cycles, and the number of subject certificates, 109,378. Some of those candidates may still be in the system completing those subjects as we speak. Some of them have dropped out. It depends on the circumstances that they have not completed the full requirements to meet certification for the full qualification. Just here, so that the members understand the records rejected column, we indicated that records rejected column so that you can, as members, see that there are still some unresolved certificates. We negotiated long and hard with the quality assurance body to allow us to continue with the certification process and to come back and revisit those that were problematic and challenging. Because if we had just saw, for example, just on 2007-11, we did not know how long it would take with the FITA track record to resolve those 36 errors. Once the certification of level 2 and 3 has been completed, these rejected records will be prioritized and will be dealt with accordingly. At this stage, we cannot say how many of those candidates will get certificates Some of them may have dropped out of the system, may no longer be participating in the qualification, but those statistics we will give as process is concluded. Then in terms of the level three, we have progressed already with the first year of the level three candidates for the offering of the NCB. The statistics are provided there. 8,155 certificates and 1,956 full certificates. And the totals and the rejected records are provided there. So in terms of the level three, we have to acknowledge that we continue to experience a challenge with the seekers, the reliability of the data given to us, and the turnaround time. And we need to acknowledge, and perhaps I can explain it in the following manner. Level two, we have certificates. To certificate level three, we have to look back to level two and the data sets of level two. And what we found specifically, a challenge that has arisen in this process that we need to acknowledge so that UJ and the members of the House are aware of this, is that there's been a mismatch in the data when they look back from level three to level two, which needs to be resolved. For example, subject codes is one of the errors that they are now experiencing at the moment as they read back to the level two data to issue level three certificates. These, unfortunately, members have to be corrected manually. They are not errors that can be corrected programmatically by writing a program and correcting it. Due to the age of the system and the manner in which the system has been structured, the current IT system we are using, we, in terms of dealing with this very, very sensitive challenge, have already put certifications in place and are tendering for the establishment of a new IT system, which we have already reported to the House, to resolve these issues so that we do have a responsive IT system that can indeed deal with the size of the system and the nature of the qualifications we offer as a national examining body. So that concludes the inputs and the report back on the certification process. In terms of the resulting of the April 2013 engineering studies candidates, 144,752 candidates participated at 321 national examinations across the country in the trimester one examination. We received, as we do in any examination cycle, we received reports from examination centres, both during the writing sessions and the marking process, about the irregularities that they had observed and caught candidates in the act of during the examination cycle. Some of these included question papers being found in the possession of a candidate prior to the writing of a paper as the candidate was going into the exam hall, or somebody came to report, you know, somebody has this paper in their possession. Crib notes that closely resembled the question paper layout, crib notes that didn't resemble the question paper layout, that just were quite arbitrary, and technical errors such as students not inserting their ID numbers on their answer script. The technical errors comprise a very small percentage of these irregularities. So it is on the nature of the first two irregularities that I mentioned, finding candidates in possession of these question papers, and crib notes, finding crib notes that closely resemble the structure of the question papers, that the department made the decision to withhold the results, and in consultation with the quality assurer, was given the opportunity to engage in a preliminary investigation to ensure that indeed only those candidates who had earned the marks indeed got their marks. This then led to 29 subjects being affected, and 35 examination centres of the 321 being implicated in the leakages. The department, at all times when such incidents occur, acts in the interest of the integrity of the qualification and to protect those candidates that indeed have honestly worked and studied to write the examination. 211 candidates, on conclusion of our preliminary investigation, were found to have been involved in dishonest conduct linked directly to the leakage of question papers, which led to the delay in the release of 387,844 subject results across the 144,752 candidates. if we look at in terms of the percentage and the size of the problem, 19,281 subject results, affecting 4.9% of the total number of subject results, had to therefore be withheld when all other results were released on the 24th of May. So we negotiated with the Policy Council that please do not withhold all results. We have evidence in these 29 results showing that it's only in these, I beg your pardon, in these 29 subjects that there is indeed a big question mark and we need to review and look at those subjects. So we were last on the 24th of May, released all other subjects except the results of the 29 subjects implicated. If we have a look at what is the size, what is the nature, when we look at the engineering studies, on N2 to N3, 15 question papers were affected out of the 78 question papers written. 167 candidates were directly implicated, that is 0.17% of the candidates that actually wrote those subjects. If you look at it, 167 out of 97,142. This then led to us withholding the results of all candidates in those particular subjects only, pending further investigation. For N4 to N6, 14 question papers were affected out of the 85 question papers written, and on this level, 44 candidates were directly implicated, which represents 0.14% of the 31,988 candidates that wrote the affected subject. And we therefore had to withhold the results of all candidates in those subjects pending further investigation. Our preliminary findings into the second round of investigation show the following. That in terms of the measure taken by the department to insert a unique identifier into question papers, at the end of the process, in terms of our internal quality control and chain of command of question papers, we found that when the papers were returned to us, the leaked papers, they all included these unique identifiers, which led us to the conclusion that the leakages are taking place outside of the department once and after the papers have been dispatched to examination centres. So that unique identifier has helped us to establish, Chair, indeed, that we can start looking in a specific direction for the source of these leakages. Candidates and college officials at indicated centres, that's the number of 35 centres that are indicated, have been interviewed. The preliminary findings indicate that in some instances, candidates did indeed have footnotes, and some of these were related and others were unrelated to the question paper. That ghost writers were writing, which had implicated invigilators at some centres, have been implicated in the process. Candidates did indeed assist one another in some of the venues. That question papers were indeed available for sale in some areas prior to the writing thereof. The candidates were willing to admit to us that they had bought the paper from person X, but in some instances, candidates were unable to take us back to the actual source, so we have yet to identify the actual source. We have also found that some of our private colleges have been opening question paper bags ahead of time to distribute to what we call satellite campuses, and these are unregistered campuses, which is contrary to the national policy on the conduct of exams, and in terms of that process, the department has met with the Association of Private Providers of Education, Training and Development to request their cooperation and collaboration to clean up the act of assessment practices, exam practices at our private institutions. Sanctions will be imposed on all implicated students and where necessary the relevant lecturer or invigilator in the process. As due process, we have opened cases with the South African Police Services to facilitate the prosecution of the implicated parties being indeed relevant. The principals of these centres, the 35 centres, have been asked to submit to the department a report indicating how these irregularities occurred and how they are going to eradicate the recurrence of such irregularity related to the leakage of question papers going forward. We have been receiving those reports and will be able to consolidate them into one report as the time frames allow us. In terms of the informing the public, we have released two media releases to the public, indicating to the public the extent and the nature of the delayed release in the results. Other measures include us continuing to explore the work done with UNISA, who runs a similar type of exam structure where they have a multitude of centres spread across the country and across the world indeed, and print and distribute from one central point. Our work continues with them to minimise the irregularities and the possibility of leakages in the system. We're also reviewing our own internal policies to ensure that we can actually criminalise this activity, so that when it comes to prosecution, we are not told that the party cannot be prosecuted as it is not recognised as a criminal activity to be in possession of a leaked question paper. The distribution model for the question papers has been reviewed, and for the August, the trimester 2 exam for engineering studies will take place and be in place for that process. We are going to expand the use of the unique identifier so that we can, at this stage, indicate which province the paper leaked from, should a leak take place again in future, and whether it was a private or a public institution. And we are working very closely with the policy assurer, Umalusi, to resolve the issue as a matter of urgency to facilitate the release of results where a candidate is innocent of any wrongdoing in those results that have still been withheld. In terms of the candidates and their futures and access to continued tuition and examination processes, the engineering studies candidates have been allowed to register for subjects on the next level to ensure that the students with outstanding results are not negatively affected, and that so that tuition can also proceed in the institution. And here that then concludes the update to the committee on resulting and certification processes as requested.
Thank you very much. I think from my side, it's during my tenure here, when I was in Soba, I encountered the CETA. I think that is the State Information Technology Agency, if I'm correct, that offers our government in operate IT solutions in various spaces at huge prices. People selling this institution are getting tenders because it's a highly technical field of experts, and then they start speaking the IT language. They don't want to simplify it so that you lose interest to interact with them, because you may know this is secret now. I don't have any hope when we're talking of CETA since my encounter with them at that time. I don't even know whether they improved or whether the unscrupulous activities that caused them to go to school at that time had been resolved and the same people that they were expelled. So the CETA institution is just a problem for me. Maybe one day, one next time, if we really need to talk about CETA, they must just come. We must call them. Just see the warm bodies behind this name CETA, the real people. That's where the problem is. And then here, we've got an IT system that's unable to capture the grants properly, and still they do the exams, and ultimately they don't get certificated and so on. I think we've got the challenge of, as the department having to determine a mechanism of data storage to be able to safeguard the records that come from our centers, from all these many centers. So meaning that we must have a strategy of storing this 3 million exam papers manually. There must be a way in which it's not manually, then there are some highly complex scanners these days. We scan them without them, we keep them in the original form. We must just have a way of an ability of storing this data from the center to the department before we even attempt to load up this data on the CETA system. That is problematic. Before we finalize the new acquisition of the IT solution, which we really think must be expedited. I think the other issue that we must look at is distribution of our papers to the treatment centers. How is it done? Is there no other mechanism? If we're taking a paper manually is a crisis, is there an IT solution where at the moment of exam, paper can be sent at that time, boom, it is there and they see it for the first time, immediately it must be on the table, there must be some people, some incentivate that, I'm just saying, we must one solution, that is a thankless task for you to solve. It's quite a use was, it goes to the heart of the potential of our system. The other point is, the 6,000 students who still go to the rejector, how can we obtain certainty so that in the maybe we are able to look at who are the students from which institution, their names, ID numbers, have a database of these people, so that somehow you provide clarity to the nation, everybody could know that in fact I'm part of that, I'm rejected to court and we should be dealt with later, so that the stability the certainty in the system as to who are the affected people in this regard and so on. And as we have suggested in the last introduction, a clear communication, despite the fact that we did release statements in the public about this, a mechanism of direct engagement with our particularly 50 public equity colleges to really clarify students and the staff on these issues, or package information that relates to their particular college so that they know where they stand in regard to all these challenges that we have. If we can have that, it will really go a long way in addressing these challenges. Honourable members, Prof.
Thank you, Chair. I think you mentioned quite a few important points. I would just like for clarity to find out these almost 7,000 rejected records. With that, then the almost 10,000 with all those issues, does that mean those are, does that cover all the students, or are there still other outstanding certificates? And then secondly, Chairperson, I'm just wondering, the backlog started since 2007, and we're only trying to address the problem now. It's 2013. So what happened from 2007 onwards? Didn't anyone pick up that there is a problem with CETA? Why is it only now that this problem is being identified?
Okay, yes, now from my side also, thank you very much for the information, first of all, because we were asking for it, and we, because of the fact that we got inundated calls from students on the ground on the certification problem. And I think the explanation that we got is, we understand that it is a huge problem which needs to be finalized at some other stage. I think my colleague has asked the relevance of the time. Maybe I could also ask what happened before 2007. Let me just tell you, I've got another query here which I would like to also solve. Are people that lose their certificates and then they can't get a copy of it? So I think that is one of the issues. What records have we got of students that have completed their courses? Do we keep that in a sort of a manner that we can also easily attain it if it's possible? I think, Chair, yeah, we understand this is obviously a problem that was accumulating over time. And, I can't understand why we did not earlier really get solutions to the IT problems or whatever the other cases were. We understand that there's a huge number of people. I think the system should be very clear to all the participants, even the suppliers, the training suppliers and so on. That there should be really very, very strict rules as far as that is concerned to keep that intact. One of the questions that I have on the engineering ones, I really must commend them that the department that I want to really get the quality assurance that we don't have this type of irregularity that is taking place. And students are always like to see they learn them and they try to get these papers beforehand. But what happens now to the students that were held back until the 24th of May? The course has already started on the 8th, I think, the 8th of May, so it's more than 2 weeks that they fell behind, and it's only a 10-week course. Are they going to be accommodated? Because that is one of the other questions that we've got. Lots of people, they're not on the roll. They did not have their qualification, their certificates. They did not enroll. They were not sure if they can get NSFAS funding or whatever the case might be for it, wherever they got funding from. Everything was unclear because of the fact that it was withheld. And if they cannot carry on with it for the second trimester, then obviously they will have to carry over for another year because they cannot also carry on with the third trimester. So my question is that, are we going to accommodate or help these people, because I mean their lives are at stake and they need jobs and they are really desperate to carry on with their studies. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, mind you, see, the most painful thing is that when you write something and don't get your certificate, nobody tells you why, and you don't know where to go. You see, I've met like some people. Me, I'm not necessarily understanding the situation. A lot of people, some are still even trying to get today by mistake, or saying we didn't receive our money. And the unfortunate part of it is that nobody is able to answer to some students such why, when, and how are we going to receive them. But the most painful thing from people who are not closer to positions of influence, that's closer to that. When you go to your colleagues, no, that's how we tell. Why? We don't know, that and that. You see, that kills, you see, that destroys me. Like even myself as an MP, I think I reported this case even from you. Some of the parents are still saying even to me, go this side. That's the most we do not have a capable communication staff to deal with those problems. Many were hurting our people. We are hurting, like, other people have given hope in this thing. No, but I try to go and study what the doctor is saying. I'm not the same as some of the certificates, maybe, other courses, like if you do Java or C sharp in IT, the Java maybe you did in 2007, okay, my B11 certificate we have, might have go and advance some other programs that you might do. They even deal with the relevance of them, because the period of time that you take in terms of giving a personal certificate, that to me that seems. You see, when a poor person cannot get answers, 289 something thousand of those results, I know you have with help of those people, I'm telling you, 95% of them didn't know what was happening. Because of lack of proper communication, which you are raising, even yourself, by these colleges, and also by the department, not official, managing to communicate to our people. These investigations, if you are saying this then, and I wish that the Pastor could have seen that if we say, okay, we have a problem for 211, that within a period of two weeks, or that. But you can't have years and years and nobody knows what's going to happen. The meaning to me that this, in terms of certification, there's a similar problem would continue to happen. That's why people would always prefer going to university and establish university than going to institutions for education and training. Because of this problem, what makes you to choose a better institution is to know that you're going to get, at the end of the day, a better service. Now, this point that it's too long. Like, this is the 200, the people who affected people, 211, you were saying something like that. Affected more than 380-something thousand people. But that we couldn't resolve in a short space of time. The issue is that accreditation and quality of results is very much important. You do that. But how do you resolve, the period in which you resolve the dispute, it's very much important. Or will not have hope to what to do. Now, I'm not, speaking. It's just in my mind, in my brain. I remember those parents who were in the Department of Education and those children. That's what the doctor.
doctor is saying that they could not even some of the proceeds to their consultation. Because of 211, the spoilers who didn't want to study, when the teachers were said, time is up in January for them to start. Now, we have to have 389 people, with 389,000 people. Therefore, that the department should deal with this DG. Communication. Resolving time. Part of the extent was introduced to people there. It goes with how we give information to our people. It's so much important. And I'm not going to... this helps me, this process of certificate. Because if you've been there in basic education, the same problem, nobody cares. Others, they say, I want to go to university. I wanted to register. But my certificate is with them. Nobody, no politician cares. Minister cares, DG cares, nobody. Therefore, I can't take this one. Until there's a short space of time, we'll respond to that. We'll be giving quality education to our kids.
I think I've got a specific case which I'll communicate with the DG when he leaves. That's better that way. Yes.
Yeah, some cases may not be of Yes,
at the saving time, I like his approach.
Yes, but some of those are not just for him and the DG, are of national interest, therefore many need to know. But then this one probably does not, is not of that stage. Yes, so we can handle it with the DG. I think the
No, Charlie, that's very sad. The DG has had 2 years without a certificate. But because the objective is to solve the problem, not for publicity purposes. That's why I'm saying that.
In future, the impression data is that as we engage with the matter, we're seeking publicity and not resolving issues. And I don't think that is the case. But it's fine. I think we can accommodate him. I think I understand equally the approach as you said. Chair, the department says that the policies are silent or they don't provide for these kind of challenges in terms of criminalizing us. But at the same time, some cases have been opened with substance. And where students are involved, there will be some sanction. Of course, we are happy to see the guilty parties being acted upon. But I'm just wondering now on which basis, what would be the sanction for students based on if the department is still working on its policies and so on. I just see some contradiction there, which are likely to have some people going scot-free. The principals are said to develop plans to curb this, which is good in those respective areas where these things are. Some of them may not be involved, but I thought that we needed to even be serious or strict with them, because they are running these institutions without saying necessarily they were actively involved in that. But I'm not saying there should be a way of condemning them as well. Hoping that the policies ultimately will refine that kind of situation.
No, it's good. This can only be a very broad comment because I've not had the presentation. And also sympathize with the points raised by Honorable Panda. Because at times the department might have a feeling that we are sensationalist and all those things. I mean, VG and the staff, look, I'm looking at these things I'm separating where are irregularities, you know, that we are investigating this. As you have on your record, people who, since 2007, have not, are still waiting. And I'm asking myself, how does the country go to sleep? It may be something, maybe a very small number, but somebody really, what is happening to this? Do we know where they are now? Do we know what they are doing now? If somebody really, this is serious, somebody must actually go to them, individually, and counsel them, and address them. I've seen something, I was not aware, I saw, this is from basic education, a student who wrote an exam, grade 12, some 3 years, I'm still waiting for a certificate. But at least this student has been given a letter. Use that letter, the letter says the student has passed. There are issues with the certificate, so the student is continuing the study at a university. What is happening to these people? Do we know where they are? And when people come to conclusions and say people don't care, we may sound like we are too sensationalist, but we know the department cares, but they just don't show it.
Chair, I want to be very, very positive. We have lamented about the situation of certificate backlogs for too long now. But it appears as if there is a process to clear the backlog. I want to suggest that let's monitor the process closely. Possibly we will get to where we want to get to. And then have this matter behind us once and for all. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. On the first question and the very valuable comment, firstly, we really take this matter serious, and we are doing everything we possibly can to address the matter. Now, on the data, we realize that we are flogging a dead horse, having done everything. And that is why we went to the executive and subsequently to cabinet to ask for special dispensation in terms of new IT regime, which is going to be responsive to these critical challenges, in order to ensure that we uphold the integrity of the entire system, especially the certification of our keys. And the matter we are doing, not on the basis that we fear will be appearing to the portfolio committee, but we owe it to those thousands and thousands of children who went through a whole year, 3 year period, sat behind the desk, wrote exams, but at the end of the day, they don't get a certificate. That's how serious we take this matter. Now, we've gone quite substantially far in securing the services of an IT, and it's to the tune of 56 million. And we think for this kind of work, it's really nothing. We've raked and the reprouts arrive within the department to make this money available. That's what we are doing in terms of IT. But in the interim, we are actually working and loading data manually, you know, ourselves in the department, in order to ensure that in the interim, we are able to live to the rights of the children who wrote the examination. So we are actually doing everything possible. On the distribution, I've already met the High Commissioner, the Commissioner of Police, and discussed this matter. And there is a structure we've agreed that we need to establish and elevate this question to a highest level possible, so that, amongst other things, in relation to the question of distribution, intelligence services to be made available to us so that we can be able to meet this in the part. There are
they are committed into assisting in that regard. So we are doing everything, including reviewing the distribution mechanisms from the standpoint of the department in order to address this matter. And we have also met the private providers, because in some instances we are let down by them. They open these papers before the date of writing the examinations. We have the evidence, you know, to that. We put it to them and we want them to assist in addressing this matter and combating criminality within their own constituency. And we have agreed to establish a permanent structure which is going to work and monitor on this on this development. We have taken, you know, stern action on this matter. I must say, this period of transition was exploited by staff, because in as much as the function was shifted to the Department of Higher Education and Training, but in terms of employment, we are still residing with provincial departments. We have only taken charge since the 1st of April this year. And on these areas of irregularities, there are principals that are in suspension already on these questions. And also in areas of incapacity within the department, we are taking action quite decisively, because we believe that a matter of this sort is not a talking issue, really. It's either able to discharge the responsibilities fully or you are out. There is nothing in between. You can't gamble with the question of certification. That's how serious we take this matter. The bad dog, it happened. That's the point of establishing this painful fact. Umalusi was of the view that they would no longer be responsible for the issuing of the certificates. They would only offer certificates for basic education only. So we had them to engage and had a legal opinion on this matter, but they were of the view that it should be us who are certificating students in FET colleges. So the point, however, was we can't be an examiner as a department and a quality assurer of ourselves at the same time. There is an anomaly in there. It has to be rectified. And indeed, we arrived to that conclusion and the decision that no, they should actually continue. And they've been working on it. Of course, in terms of consultation, there has been these problems since 2007, and we are working hard into addressing this much as I have outlined. In terms of communication, this matter partly is as a result of governance and management weaknesses in FET colleges that we are also addressing and taking requisite measures and actions and sanctions where it is actually appropriate to address this. For instance, when we wanted to take human action to some of these principals and managers, we didn't get cooperation in some provinces, because we would investigate, come up with all the evidence, but at the end of the day, it's them who have got signing power. But ever since we took over, there is concrete actions that we have taken, because everything we're able to do ourselves, including some of the measures I have just indicated. That is why, when this thing happened, I think we issued two statements in the media, over and above the mechanisms that we put in place at college level into ensuring that there is communication. But we realize that that hasn't been sufficient. We need to actually do more in ensuring that we communicate. And the sanctions that are taken, the suspensions the view of subjecting people to disciplinary inquiries, and we are opening up criminal cases where there are cases of fraud or theft, but also we want to strengthen the police, also the act, even copying, to become a criminal offense, not just, you know, one of these offenses. But that's what we are looking at doing in trying to strengthen the legislation. I think my colleagues will pick up on some of the other pertinent questions. Nadine?
Chair, just to indicate, in terms of the numbers, those indeed are the numbers, okay, and it is on the system, so there will be no further numbers than numbers indicated on the slide. With regards to the assistance of candidates who are wanting to get into higher education, into the workplace, we have been issuing those letters. We have sent out communiques to the college principals indicating that should an entire centre require these letters, we will be willing to assist. And in fact, one of our colleges did request that, and all the way back to when first, in 2009, when the NCD was first offered on their form, it issued letters to each and every candidate at that particular college. We sent that invitation out twice. Individual requests come in, and we deal with them from the college side. If a student approaches us themselves, we also assist them. We even intervene and speak to the registrars of the higher education institutions as well as organizations of employment to assist these candidates to indeed access these different pathways so that they are not disadvantaged in terms of their employability and their further education studies. And in terms of the records, Chair, yes, indeed, those candidates, it is possible to give the information for those that have been rejected, and as you've recommended, communicate accordingly with those colleges so that those candidates understand the situation and that it's not the case that there's been nothing forthcoming, but that indeed it has just been delayed in terms of that process. In terms of the instance, et cetera, my other colleagues will deal with that question and the ability of the candidate to continue to the next level.
Well, thanks very much. I think just to remind the committee, when we debated legislation not a long time ago, I asked a legal technical question. Because we are passing the legislation here, it says this is unlawful. Where is the section on sanctions? Because you cannot have a law that is something unlawful, but without consequence. It's a matter of law. I could not persuade the committee to take my route. And I do not want to be arrogant at that level. Because I was only providing free legal help. If you say something is unlawful, it must then be an offense. There must be some form of sentence or fine. It is always at the bottom. So, now, in higher education, the issue of a person failing to follow rules, maybe it will be in the institutional statute, that if you write your examination with your books as a source of answers, you'll be expelled as a student, your course will be unrecognized or deregistered and so on. All those things. But at least the committee on its own has graduated on this one. Now when you see legislation, you must always see also the bottom. That is the consequence. For instance, if principals of universities are stealing money off universities, why should we be helpless? Why should the only issue be dissolution of a council? That means if I'm clever and a fuck, I can just set in a council, get billions, and then you dissolve me and I won't eat my billions. You see, now you're going to depend on common law principles or look at other judicial offences established by other committees. So when the law relates to us, let's also look at issues of that aspect. The DGM, you said you are going to be acting, we just hope you don't expel the people because of a systematic problem. If you are saying it's a systematic problem, then incapacity will start with capacitation, training of your staff. So that they know these are the things, putting the proper systems in place
to engineer the system. I think governments who very deeply about that approach to be useful in many instances. We really would like to see this matter of certification results. We would like the CETA to disappear from our report and start talking about this new IT solution, how far it will go to solve our problems, and a better mechanism of distribution, data storage, and communication in relation to those that are affected in this area so that we could avoid the instability that is related to all this concern. And let us go to Ernest.
Yes,
possibly a discussion for another thing, but relevant. I appreciate the fact that the department now has a new IT system. But you see, attempts, and I've heard the cry. We need that as seen yesterday. But Shepherdson, another reality now, as a parliament now, we must know that we have double party. Because you have an institution called CETA, who are being paid, there are people there and are unable to deliver. I don't know whether it should just satisfy us to say no, we'll just abandon it. Very soon nobody goes there. I don't know how we are going to handle it. People might just look at processes of how we are going to intervene. Because this is a report to some committee in parliament. Whether we should not be talking to that committee to try and unblock.
I think there must be a referral to the appropriate committee. We are also entitled to call them here and also invite the other committee if it can be necessary. But I thought we were reached a stage where if we call them, it will be just on the historical record recovery so that we are able to help those whose records are still in their hands. And just to listen, yes?
No. To get their act together. Not for purposes of this one. This one we are passing. Even if the backlog is stopped tomorrow, we still have a problem. We have had, as a country, we had to go and get something else. We're paying for food, but somebody's cooking horrible meals at home, and this person is allowed to continue cooking and spend money on the food that nobody eats.
I think that also needs to be dealt with. Just to add to what we're saying, in departments, in local government at all levels, you see, you find that they've appointed legal experts or legal advisors. But those legal advisors work is to refer to external lawyers to get legal opinion and prepare a document for court and all that. Apparently, it's how the state works. They employ an IT expert just to be there to earn money, and then that person packages documentation for giving consultants work. the one must receive. That's important. We must receive the system. Our answer is to receive. Now we're beginning to diagnose the issues, and perhaps we are going to go further for solutions. That's first into the third part. Yes, that's right.
May I just quickly ask a question for clarity? This report was on the NCV certificate. The report 191 certificates, have they all been issued?
Thank you very much, Chair, and good afternoon. Good morning, honourable members. I'll be talking you through a fairly short presentation, I hope, on the purported shortfall within the surveyed guests and training colleges. But I think before I do that, my presentation will also just give background in terms of the process of determining the bursary allocations for colleges, on the basis of which then colleges are expected to manage and administer the bursary funds. And I think that background is important in order to give the honourable members a sense of the preparatory work. That it is that the allocations are not necessarily done arbitrarily. Perhaps yes, there's room to improve on how these allocative decisions are made, but the decision on the bursary allocation for a college is not necessarily done arbitrarily. So I think the honourable members are aware that compared to last year, the current allocation for 2013 is 1.98 billion rand, compared to the 1.764 from 2012. And when we calculate the bursary allocations annually, this is based on the pot of money that we're given for the funding, the program costs, as well as the actual student enrollments within the sector and across the 50 different colleges. Annually, between July and September, the Department of Higher Education and Training embarks on a process of strategic planning together with our colleges. And part of the reason for doing this is really to do two things. To begin to set performance targets, be it in terms of student performance, but also to then get a sense of the expected enrollment that a college, that colleges are projecting for the upcoming year. And this then allows us to begin to determine, at least initially, the provisional allocation for each of our colleges. And then so once we have received the projections, the enrollment projections from our FET colleges, this is usually done between September and November each annually. And once there has been a CPIX, or the Consumer Price Index adjustment for the program cost, be it report 191 or for the NCV or any of the bursary allowances, we then calculate, our planning function then calculates the bursary allocation per institution based on the pocket of money that we've been allocated. And then this information is then communicated to all of our FET colleges by the end of the planning year. So by the end of this year, we will have communicated to all of our FET colleges what their provisional allocation for 2014 will be. And again, the purpose of the rationale is that we want to allow our colleges to plan in accordance with the, you know, the resources that are available and in accordance with the projections that they have given the department. Then towards completing the cycle, because again, by December, all we're working with are the projections and not the actual student enrollment. In February, once all of our colleges have undertaken their enrollment and they've registered students, we then go back to our colleges to get the full-time equivalent enrollment, the actual, you know, student enrollment basically for the academic year. And on the basis of the full-time equivalent enrollment figure, we then determine the final bursary allocation for each college. Ideally, we communicate this, we try to ensure that by the start of the financial year, the final allocation for the college is communicated. What we see, however, is that we have significant variance between what our colleges project as well as what we then, what they then actually enroll in February. So you will note on slide number 3, whereas our the projections that we've received at the end of 2012 from the colleges, whereas the projections that we've received at the planning stage for 2013 were 263,722 full-time equivalent students, the actual FTE enrollment that we then ascertained in February 2013 was 314,807, which was a 16% increase on the initial projections that we were working on to give our colleges their provisional projections. So in light of these increased enrollments, there was, as you can imagine, a need to then think about how we reallocate the exact same amount of money across all of our institutions. Now, the increase did not happen uniformly across all of our colleges. And so the table that you're seeing in front of you details the colleges where the allocation, the final bursary allocation was lower than the provisional bursary allocation, and this was largely due to the variances in enrollment, but also not just variances in enrollment numbers, variances in terms of the actual programs in which students are themselves registered. You will note that, for instance, in the NCV, students studying primary agriculture, the cost of a primary agriculture program is much higher than a program in education or mechatronics. In fact, primary agriculture is our most expensive NCV project. So depending on the actual mix that students are enrolled in programs, that also has an implication on any adjustments that might then be required in light of the final bursary allocations and calculations that are then done there. I think again, this is an issue that relates to how our colleges then project figures and how we then work with those projections and how we then have to work with the final projections, not just in terms of student numbers, but also in terms of the actual programs in which students are enrolled. So I think again, in the next slide, what I wanted to highlight was that, again, it must be noted then that whereas in the previous slide we had the 22 colleges for whom the allocation decreased, there are 28 city colleges for whom, of which the final allocation was higher than a provisional allocation. And we've got the list sort of detailed over there. But again, just to explain what the implications then and what happens when we then have to reconcile the projections with the actuals. The difference in the variance that we must account for is actual student enrollment, the program type in which our students are enrolled. And again, when you look at the allowances that we then have, that we can then cover, so in terms of the 2012 projections for 2013, we had set aside 8.3% of the final of the bursary allocation just to cover transport and accommodation allowances. However, once we have more students in the system, part of the trade-off around access is we would prioritize tuition fees, and that then meant that we only have 3.8% left of the total allocation. That's the only amount that is then left to then cater for students' allowances for transport, travel, as well as accommodation for the students. I think I just wanted to then draw your attention to some of the institutional and broad regulatory arrangements that we have developed as a department to try and ensure the sound and effective administration of the bursary scheme. So as the point of introduction of the bursary scheme in 2007, the Department of Higher Education and Training also developed the bursary guidelines. These guidelines we review together with our colleges annually. We send out the revised guidelines based on comments that we receive from our colleges throughout the year, and these guidelines then determine on what basis the colleges manage and administer the bursary scheme. And I think once this iterative process is completed annually and once approved by the DG with the final bursary guidelines, we then have a process of workshopping these guidelines again with our ECT colleges. And this year, that workshopping happened in February with the National Student Financial Aid Scheme. And again, one of the key things that we impress upon our colleges to the structures, the institutional arrangements that they must have in place for the administration of the bursary scheme is duly constitute the financial aid committee, and we give guidelines about who constitutes the financial aid committee. We also ensure that in our guidelines we indicate that it is not possible to determine the financial eligibility for the bursary outside of the utilization of the less than means test. We also then indicate to our colleges that over and above the means test and the financial eligibility criteria, students must meet the academic criteria. And so we also set up what those academic prerequisites are and the various ways by which a college can prove. Now for existing students, that is easy because you look at their academic performance in terms of the exam cycle that we oversee. But for new entrants, it needs a careful assessment of the reports that they come with, as well as a careful assessment of the selection placement test that each of our colleges are expected to run at the start at the commencement of the academic year. And then the supporting documentation that students must submit. Certified copies of their ID, certified copies of parents' IDs, and any other supporting documentation that can make their case for their financial need. What we have found, however, as we sort of dig deeper and oversee and monitor the disbursement and the management of the bursary scheme in our colleges, has been the poor financial management of and control over the bursary scheme, and largely this has been left as a student support services function and not core to the financial management of our institution. We found insufficient and inadequately qualified staff. Again, these are the staff that largely have a student support services orientation that is not necessarily linked with the financial controls and financial oversight that is required in exercising their duties in overseeing the bursary scheme. And then a huge failure in terms of applying the qualifying criteria. And in two of the examples where we've done in-depth analysis of bursary applications, what we found is that ineligible students have been put on list for eligibility on both criteria when in fact they're not. As well as poor communication by our colleges of the eligibility criteria to students. So not informing students that actually not only must you have financial need, but you have to meet academic academic and merit criteria in order to qualify for a degree. And then we've also found that our colleges, in some instances, colleges have not established a financial aid committee. And so the oversight around the actual awarding of bursaries and the recommendation that is made to NIFAC has happened outside of the institutional arrangements that we have provided for in our guidelines. And again, in the case of, and here we give the case of Umgungundlo, where that data city colleges, where we've had to restart or reopen the bursary process owing to some irregularities that were observed. And you'll notice with Lovedale, out of a total of 283 first-year student bursary applications that were received, only 61 were eligible for financial aid. Now, in that context, that very thorough verification of claims by colleges that there is a shortfall need to be done. And it is in light of this, and it is in light of these irregularities that to date, we have received from 27 FET colleges a figure of 470 million, purportedly, which is the actual bursary shortfall. But I think we are not convinced, and we have not satisfied ourselves that this is in fact what the shortfall is. I must also add that these are figures that have only been communicated to the department following the final allocations that we sent. So this is information that colleges have submitted to us or request for additional funding that have been submitted to the department until the month of May by our APD colleges, May this year. Slide number 8 just gives you, 8 and 9 gives the breakdown of the colleges that have submitted a request for additional funds and the values of these requests for additional funds. Interestingly, you will notice that Lovedale is one of the colleges that has indicated that they would like additional funds. However, based on our audit of their bursary applications, only 20% of applications received were actually eligible. So there's a thorough process of verification that we are undertaking. And this process really entails enlisting the services of qualified auditors. This was the approach that was undertaken at Lovedale, and this will be the approach that will be undertaken for all the 27 colleges that have submitted applications, not just to verify the amount, but to verify that the student for whom the college is saying it is submitting a claim is still registered. In the case of Lovedale, we noticed that there were students actually who were no longer in the system, who had already dropped out, for whom, you know, allocations are being made and applications are being submitted. So that is the kind of audit, the detailed audit of those applications and of the batch of applications that we want the auditors to undertake. And the process has already commenced where our internal CFO is then engaging with audit firms to try and then get these teams to the colleges to undertake a 2-week or 3-week audit of those bursary applications in order to determine exactly what the shortfall is. And again, so really what we've started to do is a fairly detailed combing through a bursary application, which is largely operational exercise within the college, because we cannot just rely on submissions made to the department for additional funding, but we have to certify ourselves that those are in fact legitimate. The department, in partnership with the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, also we developed and have circulated a bursary management improvement manual, which was then also workshopped with the current support CFOs in our colleges. This was done in April. And the purpose of this bursary management improvement manual is really to find better alignment between the financial aid processes and the broader financial management of the colleges. For as long as we retain those separate processes, parallel processes, the longer we're going to perpetrate or oversee a system where bursary administration is improper and continue to award bursaries to students are actually ineligible for funding. And I think, you know, going also just, you know, one of the things that comes through in our deliberations today is that the department, we generally have a plan of action around how to resolve some of the challenges that we're facing, be it in examinations or be it with NISFAS. However, our communication around some of these issues is not very clear and is not always timely. And so we're also working on a media stakeholder engagement campaign to raise public awareness about the bursary scheme, number one, but also the student eligibility criteria and the required support documentation that make the case to justify the funding for the students or the candidates that we have in the system. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Standing goodness.
to do this verification with almost every college on this bazaar at the same time. I'm just thinking, is another way to indicate that in Lovedale College could be across the board or several of those. And the question is, what then is happening elsewhere? And how do we catch this so that those who need the money actually get the money and not just everybody else or institutions don't just use the money for other reasons other than what it's meant for? And I would be interested in understanding that part. See, are we able to build capacity, eat in house or otherwise, just to keep this before it actually happens?
Thank you, Shafasan. It's clear to me what happens where the ideal situation, where a college has projected lower numbers than they admit more. They expect that the department would make, you know, close the capacity where. How do you deal with instances where in one slide we're saying list of colleges, you know, the numbers are lower than the actual. I think that the money is there already in terms of the allocation than the previous year. I left it strongly the paper. But I'm also just trying to, just looking at good planning, Honorable Chairperson. This margin of error, because this thing is also budget driven. It is budget driven. A college that estimates that now will have 3,000 students, and the margin of error is 100%. Let's say they now have 6,000. I mean, can this happen? Is there some kind of indication by the department to say no, but you can't go beyond this? Because there are also other implications in CDG. There are also resources. You admit learners because you also have physical space. How do you handle this one? Because for me, it's not only about the vendor. There are other issues. Or whether, you know, you can end up with a classroom that are overcrowded, I'm just not very sure. The third one relates to Honorable Quellen's touch on it. Because, see, unfortunately, when some of these mistakes are done, on closer scrutiny, you discover that some of them are really not mistakes, things that are done intentionally because of corruption, just things that are done in bad faith. I don't know if they've been able to pick these things out. I mean, during my student days, we used to have a bursary from DET, Department of Education and Training at University, and the people who were administering that, you don't know the amount of power they wielded at university. And that to get a bursary at times had very little to do with merit. But your connection with them, students would really go out of their way to, you know, lick their boots, as it were. I didn't want to use the other thing that could be leaked. Let's use boots for now. But I'm just saying, where the department has found this. Because maybe that attempt is incapacity. People just don't know what they are doing. But people at times go out of their way to defraud the system. Lastly, it's an old question to the department. Now, with what, because these colleges are told September onwards to November, what more or less their allocation is. When is the student informed that you qualify? I'm saying this, Chairperson, against the background of the information that we got in the Northern Cape. Because students are saying, we only know in May. We started in January. But February, March, April, I don't know whether I have a bursary or not. I only know in May. And by then, some of them have dropped out of the system because they are notified very late. I have another question, but I'll see if there is still much chance, Chairperson, I may come back.
Thank you, Chair. In around
States in the late 80s. I was a board member of the Education Development Trust. And we are keeping our offices in all provinces. And the students were getting screened there by the time they went to university. They already had a paper to say you're qualified this or not. I'm just sure that I don't know whether we were moving twice that so that you know before you get to university. On page 5, the slide is there. The last bullet. Yes, you remember when the media stakeholder engagement can be to raise public awareness about the personal skill. I'm proposing that the department and NSFAS have used us as members of Parliament. We do have constituent offices throughout the country. And if we could get just a one-page slide, just highlighting, when I'm addressing that funeral, I'm going to phone just say thank you to everybody. I take my pamphlet and say when you come about NSFAS, these are the issues, these are something that you must think about. And I could even propose our chairperson, once we get that pamphlet, to go to this, the TV around here, this morning live, whatever you call it, and he can get a slot there to go and share about these things. Thank you.
I don't know why it's NSFAS, because we're talking about NSFAS and I think I'm not here. And I've always suggested to the administration that when we talk about things that affect the particular body, it must be invited. Because to remind members, NSFAS is looking strategy to directly take the responsibility of awarding of these amounts to eligible beneficiaries. The reason being, in universities also, universities project numbers, they get money, and then they can dismiss with, you know, they don't care about this anymore. And that's what precipitates the high dropout rate and the poor attention strategy in some of these institutions. You might find that the student has performed very well in the first year and always loses some money. That person is excluded. That's because it's going this way. And in fact, those are the people that must be thinking about, because they are showing that they are capable of going through the system. So if a person has passed all courses in the first year, why should that person still be applying for a reason? Well, that person might just automatically get money because he or she passed all courses. We focus on those people first. Before we even think of those of us who are not intellectually gifted, you cater these ones first. These ones have passed all their courses and they are from poor backgrounds, therefore they are qualified. That's why the NSFAS are going to really apply that approach. Because in that way, the money could as well be focusing on those that really would generate a return for this very substantial investment. And I think this is a point that must be looked at very, very seriously. The next thing is also then
thanks. I think the first measure we are taking on this matter after we realize the rapid of the problems, one, is to actually convert the guidelines into regulation. That's the first thing we have identified. So that it becomes quite legal and there should be consequences for wrongdoing. Planning we have identified as a huge problem when it comes to FET colleges. Certainly, you are given flawed information because this money of NSFAS is seen by some colleges as a cash cow for other wrong reasons. And that's what we are battling with at the present moment. For instance, at Lapdin, what they will do, they will advertise that everybody must come and register at the beginning of the year. Education is free. It's free. So you come, you have got bursary, you come, you have got bursary. And according to the guidelines, when they are admitting the students,
simultaneously have to make assessment, and upon admission, a student already knows whether he or she is qualified for NEPA or not. That's what was stipulated from the guidelines, but it's not actually happening. That is why we are undertaking an audit per FET college, and we want people with relevant expertise. Now, we have what capacity to do this? Because we were seeking the services of qualified service providers who actually assist us on the matter, and we're doing the monitoring. And one of the things, we have employed a qualified chartered accountant as a CFO just to focus on FET colleges. That's why we're able to undertake these measures and guidance, you know, at the present moment. We've employed, we've recruited him from PricewaterhouseCoopers. Because we wanted expertise, multi-funnel law staff, because the stakes are high. So the physical infrastructure as well. If I may just cite an example, you know, the audit was done of the utilization of the physical infrastructure which is there. We found that Igwe FET College, for instance, is actually using about a quarter of the capacity it has. Now, these are the areas that are prompting us to actually get deeper. And it looks in FET College there's a bit of a rot that we need to attend to as a matter of urgency. On the question of good learning, we agree. That's why we're taking this measure. The people we discover, you know, another example, we made available 16 million here to North Lynn FET College. They take 15 million, they pay salary. They use only 1 million for NEPA. Students riot. It's right. What is the problem? No, it's NEPA. But what has happened to the money? Upon that investigation, we find that no, in actual fact, the money was not used for the purpose it was meant for. These are just some of examples, you know, not linked last day, to just further illustrate some of the challenges that are out there in these FET colleges. Now, when a student is informed, according to the guidelines, a student has to be informed when he or she is being admitted. But it hasn't happened that way. That's why we're having these problems. That's why we're embarking on this measure to try to rectify it. I agree fully to request the assistance of the honorable members. That is going to be done as a matter of urgency. I think some other questions can take them.
Thanks, DG. I think the issue around the allocation and the provisional and the final, no, we don't, like you said, it's a paper, you know, at the point at which we communicate the provisional allocation to the college, there is no transfer of any funds. The transfer of funds only happens at the commencement of the financial year, and even then it does not transfer to the college. The funds are transferred from Treasury to NISFAS. And we communicate to NISFAS what the allocation for college is so that they can then know for NorthLink this is the pocket, and so they process claims up to the limit of the allocation provided. I think, again, with regard to the question about having a better way of managing the administrative burden of determining eligibility, and specifically around financial eligibility, I think that's one of the things that the NESPAC new system seeks to do. It seeks to determine financial eligibility for a bursary or for any type of financial aid while pupils are still at school, so that at the point of exit, whether into an FET college or into a university, it is clear that the only test, especially in an FET college, is around academic merit and academic need. And that should also some of the challenge with the new Nexus system, which is one of the things that we need to look at, is the SAT college sector caters largely to the needs. It caters to people who have been out of contact with the system for a long time. And so there will still be, in the transitional period, a process by which our colleges will still need to determine financial needs for older people who haven't necessarily, who NSFAS has not been in contact with while they're in school. But I think over time, that should change. And increasingly, we see more and more candidates entering the ACT college system with financial eligibility criteria already having been determined. And I think, yes, I definitely think it's exciting to know that we do have an unutilized instrument, which is the parliamentary constituency office, that we do have the information that we can compile into information packs for distribution. So we're definitely looking to that. Again, I think where there have been clear contraventions of the law, I can cite Elangeni, there has been proper criminal cases open, the same with Mthashana, as well as Umgungo, who we've recommended for the suspension of the SSS, the Student Support Services Manager, who was in charge of Berkeley. So we are also increasingly taking very bold steps about dealing with instances where within administration of the college, there has been maladministration and willful maladministration of the Berkeley school.
My issue is for the fact that I've got a set of minutes for adoption, and before Parliament rises, these minutes must be adopted, and it is only now, and it's quarter to one. You see, that is my challenge. You see, I'll allow maybe, because in this committee we don't really suppress members. It's our perspective.
No, it's just one thing. Most of the institutions give a student blank forms to complete without saying this is the money you are going to be getting, and that's where the gap for this program is. You know, because it needs to be kept. I don't think there's any discussion about the interest. This thing of students coming in by giving blank forms, they commit and they sign it when they don't even know what to figure.
The issue is abdication of power by NSFAS. Because in terms of law, that's not how it must be. I mean, it's NSFAS that has got powers to allocate, not the university, unless it is written somewhere. Now, the universities are an agent of NSFAS, and to some extent, they've taken responsibility. Full responsibility. I think that's why now they must change it. Now, thanks very much. Let me thank the DG and his team for the comprehensive report we received today. We'll meet in September, not anytime soon. Yeah, we're meeting in September around the 18th. So you've got plenty of time to deal with the challenges in your department.
An appeal. I got this documentation on my computer at 12:55 yesterday, and we had an afternoon meeting which ended at 8, which means we cannot read it. I'm just making an appeal. Could you please get the documents in time?
There are guidelines, parliamentary guidelines on as to how we must transmit that better administration in the department will smoothen that effect. Thank you very much. Let's proceed. We can adjourn the break for a minute. And then we don't have to think about it. We don't have to talk about it. Or else, let's proceed to the minutes without the break. Yes. Let's proceed to the minutes of the 22nd. Of May.
Shall I take the page to them? The paragraph is 3.1.
Okay.
certificate made pages through the paragraph 3.1, it is the second bullet. It says committee raised concern regarding the format of the presentation submitted by the CTSO in that it did not articulate on specific targets and programs of action as required by the committee. Subsequent to this concern, the committee was not pleased to proceed with the presentation. I'm suggesting that we rephrase if we need to put that concern again, we could say over and above this concern, the committee was not prepared, not pleased, was not prepared to proceed without the blah, 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 blah. And I'm not sure whether we should stay there without the accounting office, accounting authority. Accounting authority at this point, I would rather be more specific and say without the CSO, CEO, or whatever. Just a proposal.
Dealing with reports of entities, we need the board, the accounting authority. It's the board that accounts. You really, in terms of requirements, need the board. Usually, the chairperson of the board will contextualize the presentation and give over to the CEO or whoever has been mandated in administration to proceed with the presentation.
When you say board, it's a board of 15 members. Mm-hmm. Are we saying we need a quorum of them to be here, or we specifically are comfortable with the chair and CEO here?
Normally, the board will sit at its own meeting and consider their reports and then send delegation to Parliament. It may not be the entire board. They may mandate the chairperson or the deputy chairperson or any other member of the board to come with administration to come and represent their thoughts to the committee. And if there are serious letters of accountability which the committee requires the board in its entire time account, you can invite the entire board to come.
When you say without the accounting authority, you put it in black and white, it is as though you are expecting the accounting authority to be here.
Let's see away.
No, no, the chair is right. We're separating accounting officer from the accounting authority. Because your accounting officer, your CFO, your CEO, they are employees. But by law, the accounting authority is the board. Now we have instances where you only have the employees who don't make laws, who implement. And we are saying, no, but there must also be the authority. Or no, regardless of how they are represented, whether they send one or two people, as long as there is somebody who speaks on behalf of the authority rather than the implementers who are the officers.
I also remind the members, this began a very serious debate at the beginning of our term, the fourth parliament, when we were calling ministers to lead delegations to account. It was precisely on this issue of who accounts and so on and so forth. And in the long run, we will relax their approach and DGs or even other people below them would come and make presentations and so on. Initially, members were insisting on ministers to come.
That's easy to pay three. The paragraph is 3.2. It is the second bullet. The core functions of the CHE included maybe one, providing advice to the minister on any aspect of higher education, quality assurance, qualifications framework, and published information. There's something missing there, especially at the end, and published information, reports on speech. I don't know, there's something there, I don't know what it is, there's something that doesn't read well.
Information? Yeah? Why can't it be end or report and remove that stroke?
Come with a general suggestions, Chair. When we are listing these things, it's going to come up in the bread below. When you are listing a number of things, could I suggest that you start with a colon, and then after every other semicolon, so you can see that you are listing these things, so that you can be shown on this, providing advice to the minister on any aspect, high education, semicolon, quality assurance, semicolon, qualifications, framework. But I'm that proposing that. They actually apply, for example, in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the fifth bullet. They were listing a number of things. I'm just proposing we use the same format, the city plan to conduct the research on a column there, and then you list all those other things. If you are happy with that. Okay, can I take you to the following bullet? This AC required. There, I'm happy you have no problem with that, but I'm trying to get used to this Vice Chancellor of Academic Learning. Is that a term that you call this Vice Chancellor? Vice Chancellor of Academic Learning? You call them Academic Learning? Please. Oh, no problem. Can I take you then, say, people coming, can I take you to page 4? The paragraph is 3.4. The sub-paragraph is 3.2. The committee was interested to know progress in accreditation of programs that will be offered by the NVCH, our universities. Can I take you to page 5, paragraph 3.5, the very first bullet. The city spends less funds than the actual allocation in the previous financial year. I want to add years, previous financial year. And I accumulated the surplus of 9 million. Into some projects, I want to put in there that were not implemented, and then full stop. That were not implemented, full stop. Do I take you to 3.6? In 3.6, that's one bullet there. When you say a detailed, the third line, a detailed brief would be given. I suggest a detailed briefing. Do I take it to the last bullet there? Accreditation of professional programs was done on condition that they were recognized by professional bodies, councils. High institutions should do not. I have suggested take out the should and say HIs do not offer. Just take up, delete the should. That is what is in my basket.
Yes, sir. Okay, thank you. Changes that I would like to suggest on 3.4 and page 4. If you go down that bullet, the next bullet should be 3.4.1, then the next one 3.4.2, and so on. So it's all related to 3.2, otherwise we get mixed up because I want to take you to 3.3, actually 3.43. The committee wanted to know what then you must put in items, restructuring of undergraduate diploma, closing quotations mean, because otherwise it doesn't, it doesn't indicate what you want to explain. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Alice. This is for those corrections. For adoption, by the moved. Good. Thank you. Let's proceed to.
in relation to the same minutes?
To me, the introduction there on the first page. The second last line, it says, the report further recapitulates the vision and recommendation. I rather say it further recaptures. It is the same thing in the next paragraphs as we have just discussed. So it's the same cut and piece, so I don't have to repeat that. On page 4, paragraph 4, the first bullet, 4.1, the council moved towards providing proactive advice to the minister. I don't think it will move it, but it does. It's already given that. If I take you to, if we're ahead with that, I take you to 4.2, the second bullet. The last sentence. This further delayed the appointment of human capacity required, given the fact that the rollout of these programs was expected in 2014. That cannot be the cause of the delay. That sentence needs to be rephrased. This further delayed the appointment of human capacity required, given the fact that the rollout of these programs was expected in 2014. I'm not addressing anything that I'm saying, we need to rephrase it. It cannot be a cause, that last part of it. On page 4, paragraph 4.2, the second bullet. If you read that, this further delayed appointment of human capacity.
Required. Were we concerned at that moment with appointment of lecturers? I don't think so. In the last meeting, we never spoke about the lecturers being a project. We were concerned about programs being accredited and registered. And you would have to say that they're saying the PQ has been submitted. You see, we follow all these statements. The council advocates that nothing is before us, but they don't know that it's a comprehensive PQM in the language of Manpower Academy submitted, which means there are many programs submitted. But the CHE does not know that. That's why I'm empowered to follow up with the PQM. Now we don't talk about programs. We'll see a PQM and maybe that will reconcile these differences.
I've lost Prof. some halfway, so if I need to make a correction, which you already done, just you can help me. But on page 3, the third last bullet on that page, in the middle there somewhere where it's says that, where shall I start reading? Academic learning, the next line would be concluded in July 2013. However, the main challenge was that currently universities operated in a market way, but I don't think that really is correct. I think we should say in a competitive market, and it needs a way out. And we're not keen to collaborate. They operate in a competitive market, and we're not keen to collaborate. If you got it. Then the last bullet, before the last line, approve the framework for quality enhancement. There must be a reason to insert it. Thank you, sir.
Okay, let's proceed to the... So the report is adopted, obviously, because we don't record the correcting and whatever. Again, I moves and then President second. Let's move to the minutes of the 12th June. The 5th June.
So, may I give you to the second page? 5th June. The last bullet.
Yes.
In terms of the truth is saying in terms of career and the immediate line that follows should be would be distributed. Are you with me?
I'm with you.
Oh, yeah. Then proceeding to the third page, just before 2.2, the last bullet, the second line, was it comes as saying administration could work. I was saying administration cost work. And remove the S or cost one here. And the other that I was not sure whether we needed to keep it that way or not is the other 2.2, the first bullet, 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth line, says the referring to the 185 million rand balance remained invested. I know there are challenges we're dealing with this presidential thing with those challenges. Whether the money remains invested or there are challenges with the investment,
that money will not be there anymore. They are trying to sell assets to return it to the.
I thought it is a story developing. So what they knew, it's correct to the extent that they thought it was invested. Until you get in the next report that you know, they found out that the money was not. So because it was, you were reporting step by step what was being said, it may just be correct.
Point is, yes, but then we had received a report.
Yeah.
So we're writing in it ourselves of what the situation is supposed to be now. And I'm saying, to my understanding, we may not be able to say the money remains in us.
Yeah, I think I agree with the speaker because the next line, and that next sentence starts with no further payments were made by Fidesz besides naming the securities from Tesla. So it indicates that it's outstanding and not invested. Because they requested a repayment.
Let's put us still here. I think it's proper because we're trying to recover the money and apparently we are not going to tax it to recover all of it.
Okay, come in. It's the same paragraph, and that last line. No further payments were made by the agency besides numerous requests. I want to change that decide to despise, numerous. The following bullet, the claim of 25 was submitted to the curator. That's putting a B before the curator. The next bullet, the second line, Arthur Brown pleaded guilty to fraud and was fined, I'm adding was, $550,000. Second line, last bullet. Arthur Brown pleaded guilty to fraud and was fined. Do I take it to the next paragraph? Unfortunately, the second sentence. Unfortunately, there hasn't been progress in the case thus far. Forensic or judgment relating to the case were available to the committee to. I'm suggesting that we put that, instead of saying forensic documents, let's say sensitive forensic documents. That's why we decided to make them confidential. Okay. The next bullet, the strategic plan of SPECTA for 2011 was approved only in January 2012, with 2 months left to the end of the financial year. For the 2012-2013, the strategic plan for 2012-2013, I'm suggesting we take out the second 2012-2013. We're saying therefore the 2012-18, the strategic plan, we delete the second 2012-2013. We continue with that sentence was approved in October 2012, 5 months before the end of the financial year. On page 4, let's cross over to page 5, the very first bullet. The RPL program was for motor mechanics and this industry that I followed travel regulations thing. Regulations, self-regulation. The next bullet, the maximum period of an administrator in SPECTA was 2 years, and end of June 2013 symbolized end of the term. I suggest we take out the symbolized and say the end of 2013 was the end of, I suggest again, the term. As end of the term. It's not symbolizing, it is the end. The next one, 3.8, I was requested to explain whether there was a system for a change. I don't know what that means. Whether there was a system for a change when the term of administrator ended. I don't think we mean what we're saying, that there's something. I go to the next bullet. This new CEO was appointed by cabinet. Is that true? Is the CEO appointed by cabinet?
I don't think so. That's not appointed CEO. The minister.
In terms of practice, when CEOs and DGs are appointed, every minister runs that report to cabinet, but it's not necessarily the minister.
I also I was sleeping. If you went, I allowed that to go through. You can allow you to go through the tour of service, but there are some sound. For a card name, speak that they are going to appoint the CEO. The next bullet, and the same bullet, at the end, the very last sentence, President, he said that the center would continue delivering its target till 2016. Is it done in 2016? What about in 2016?
End of its
affair.
Yes, the minister will have decided that it must still exist, or they might realize sales or approach some of his functions or others.
You could qualify. It doesn't sound sound when you put it there. It just doesn't sound sound. My budget.
Another comment? Option and remember? Second of the facts. Let's proceed to the report inversions to the figures.
We'll just change the recapitulator again to recapture. Is the report the first page, second first time introduction. We just change the recapitulator to recapture and repeat with the minutes. And that in terms and what it will be the same thing on second page. I think everything is the same here. We don't have to repeat that.
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing. I take you now to page 4. Page 4.1, the very first bullet. Because the credential to the leadership and how the 185 million, the committee noted the following concerns. The credential to the leadership and how the 185 million outstanding balance would be. It doesn't, I'll take out of the credential. I don't know why we should note that one. I'll start with it concerned how the 185 million outstanding funds would be. So I'll delete that first part. The second bullet, it says the same that data submitted as a the annual performance plan in 2013 to the to Parliament. Well, to Parliament. Without a signature, yes, was erroneous. I would like to say it was serious. When I say it's erroneous, I don't know. Are we comfortable with erroneous? If we are comfortable with erroneous.
You can't say it is erroneous. Formally, when you submit documents to Parliament, they must be signed by the appropriate people. And this instead, they send the signed copy, they brought the signed copy with them. Noticing that the email was sent.
It would be them who are saying it was an error. So you can't speak on the matter that it was wrong.
That's inappropriate.
May I take you to page 5, paragraph 4.2, send bullets. The multi-year funding for the for full qualification, I just saying that where to where students would be funded at 31,000. I change the where to where, and then I put at just before 31,000. 4.3 second bullet. Delaying the appointment, I change on to off. Second bullet, paragraph 4.3. Is that a comment on your paragraph 5? To me, those are very important resolutions. my comedy, why are these not reflected in the minutes? If you read paragraph 5 on page 5, the following form required of the key resolution. Ted to compile something, something, but if you go to the minutes, you won't find these verses. I'm just saying, why are we not, why are we leaving that important resolution in the minutes?
The bond and top phrase is valid. We need to transfer this aspect also to the ministers and solutions.
I take you to the last page, page 6, conclusion, same paragraph. With regard to tender, the committee demanded answers on the judicial courageous. I don't know what that means. When you say it would demand answers on judicial courageousship. I'm on page 6, paragraph 7, the conclusion. I'm reading the first line of the second paragraph. With regard to tender, to theta, the committee demanded answers on the judicial courageousship.
Yeah, I think the answer on the judicial courageousship is relevant. We don't need any answer about the judicial courageousship. It is a matter that caused the others that know. Now there are questions for this company. Maybe we raise concerns. We sought a comprehensive report as to what transpired since 6 up to now regarding our investment in Indonesia. The board. Not the curators. The curators are some independent people that have been appointed by a court of law to administer the affairs of Indonesia. Now, we are an investor in Indonesia, and we want to desist from it. And we will plan to ascend from our own board as to how did they invest in Fidesia? What were the motivation and upon realization that this was a huge fraudulent transaction, what action did they take and how are they going to recover our money?
Friend gave you the report that my question is whether the board seriously. We might be interested in finding answers, but they still exist. Hence my thing, maybe they could.
I understand what you're saying. The master is a board now. That doesn't mean board, members of, but the current board, as a juristic person, will have to explain efforts and say the two just got this and that. But in the committee, for instance, if you read the big report, you will feel particularly interested to hear from members of the previous board. You are entitled to call them in terms of the rules of parliament.
Not on concerning, it's just on conclusion, the second line, or second sentence, in its quest for robust oversight.
Okay, can you continue there on the same judicial line, that very same paragraph, the second sentence after, is 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. Let's start the fourth line. As much as Teta carried on with his mandate with Leather Fund, the fiduciary curatorship affected Kikini. It cannot be the fiduciary curatorship. So the curatorship has something to do with that sort of thing. It is the fraud that affected it.
Yeah, the fraud.
point that. Yes.
The
presidential fraud, something like that. Yeah. The last one, Chair, is on the last paragraph. 1, 2, 3, I'm starting on the third line. During his tenure, Kemsita developed a new delivery model which would replace the use of intermediaries who benefited more than 800 million in Havant aid to users. That is all.
Any further comments? Adoption? Yeah. Okay, we'll move to adoption. Another problem? Oh, yeah. I don't suppose one. Otherwise, thanks. Now, the joint meeting, if this meeting was called at the instance of base location, the minutes will be adopted at that level. Yes, by then. So, so the term? We don't, will not the minutes as a draft of the meeting we had. And if there are any letters to be tabled, the chairperson of the board will come to the other side to consult with us as to which issues to be raised in the House. Let's proceed with the minutes of the 12th June. Medusa. Is it written by now?
they apparently they will write that members must just know that on their diary that they receive communication to go to Medusa. The minister will be interacting with the university council and the people there. On Friday, apparently there is the youth parliament. Here is to tell the youth parliament commission. I don't know whether it's proper. It's the youth parliament commission. Do you call it the youth parliament? It must be youth parliament. It's a central parliament. The central parliament is taking place. And one of the issues to be covered is education and youth development. Youth members will be available to attend so that we could understand the challenges raised by our people regarding education and skills development, and also to feed them with information from our perspective, because we've got the advantage of meeting the department on a monthly basis and so on, get the process from them. We have a better understanding of the challenges and then the progress. Yes, it's fine.
Chairperson, maybe we can just make a special request. Our previous experience with, for example, youth parliament, you'll find that it's so full, you can't find seats. And people are jostling and all those things. Maybe, for example, I'd like to attend. Maybe we could talk to Anel just to make sure that that part is done. Because the last part was something very close to it.
Let's check as to how members, the protocol for members' attendance will be effectuated so that they are not doubled over by the actual attendance of the parliament. Thanks very much. Another matter, there's no other issue. Okay, thank you, Mr. Minister.